Research is on evolution of genotype and environmental interactions. I think it's a nurture problem. You can see he's doctorate in genetics at the University of Ferrara in Italy, and his PhD in botany from the University of Connecticut. He's currently working on a PhD in philosophy at the University of Tennessee. He's published 47 technical papers and 2 books on evolutionary biology. Dr. Papunji has been awarded several times the Oak Ridge National Labs Award for Excellence in Research and has won the prestigious Papunji Prize from the Society for the Study of Evolution. As a skeptic, he's published in national magazines such as Skeptic and Skeptical Inquirer. He's given lectures from many humanist and free thought groups around the country and has debated several creationists, including Dwayne Gish and Hogan. He produces a monthly e-column called Rational Speaking and is offered Tales of the Rational, Skeptical Essays about Nature and Science, available in the lobby. His most recent, some of his selected skeptic publications include Bioscience, Skeptical Inquirer, and one title in particular to point out, A Case Against God, Science and the False Probability Question in Theology. Dr. Ken Taylor is considered by many to be one of the leading authorities on science and Bible, and he's dedicated to the proclamation of factual scientific evidence that supports the biblical record of creation. His seminars, he writes, have caused even the most devout evolutionists to sit up and take notice. He's a 15-year veteran high school science teacher, and his love for science sparks his interest in creation versus evolution. He saw the need for exposing evolution as a dangerous religious worldview and for arming Christians with scientific evidence that there are no contradictions between true science and the Bible. In response to these needs, shortly after finishing his PhD in education, he began a full-time ministry of creation science and evangelism. Since its beginning in 1989, his ministry has continued to grow, and he speaks over 700 times each year in public, and private, schools, churches, university faiths, and on radio and television broadcasts. His humorous, fast-paced, illustrated seminars provide documented evidence against and scientific theory of evolution. The information presented concerning dinosaurs in the Bible and few that are still alive today reflects his study in the field of cryptozoology. His goal is to strengthen faith of believers and to confound and convict the evolutionists and to win a lost cause. He offers $250,000 to anyone with real scientific evidence for evolution. He lives in Pensacola, Florida with his wife, Joe, and 2 of their 3 children. The 3rd child, Eric, also lives in Pensacola and speaks on creation. The format tonight will be fairly simple and straightforward. Each speaker will be given 30 minutes, and there will be no interruptions from audience or one speaker to the other at that time. And we've already decided we can go first as Dr. Papunji. And since it was a football day, naturally, we had to flip a coin when we decided we would go first. After that, we'll have a short break. We'll gather written questions. You should have received some pieces of paper as you wandered in. You'll find some folks posted in each aisle during the break. So be sure they get the questions. They'll deliver them to me, and we'll start sorting them at that time. Then, when we regather, 2 15-minute rebuttals from each side, and then a series of questions and answers. During the Q&A, the person to whom the question is directed will be given 2 minutes to respond to the question. The other person will be given 1 minute for rebuttal. Okay, Dr. Papunji.
Thank you, Dr. Carter. Thanks, everyone, for coming here. Let me tell you a couple things about what I would like to do tonight. One thing that I'm not interested in doing is in convincing anybody that there is no God. This is not that kind of debate. We're talking about science tonight. The other thing that I would like to do, on the other hand, is to tell you what evolution actually is about, because there's a lot of misconception on this particular topic. And so during my opening statement, essentially I will give you a very brief evolution 101 so that we're clear on what we're talking about. Of course, there is not enough time to give you a full course in evolutionary biology, so I have to leave out a lot of stuff. And I will focus on two or three major examples to give you a flavor of what evolutionary biologists actually do and what they're talking about. And in the following part, I will address my opponent's specific points when they come up. Incidentally, given that it's coming here in the video hundreds of times, apparently, if there is anybody here that, is, that has an aptitude for the underdog, that would be me. Okay, so what is evolution is and is not? Let me give you a roadmap of what I'm going to be telling you in the next few minutes that is useful, I think, to understand the evolution creation debate. First of all, evolution is defined in a couple of different ways, and it's not defined the way creation is defined. The way a professional biologist defines evolution is either one of these two. One, it's a change in gene frequencies. So a change in the frequencies of the genetic constitution of an organism constitutes evolution, the simplest definition of evolution. Or the more complicated definition of evolution, and actually the one that Darwin gave originally, is the central modification. That is, evolution is about change in organisms that are related to each other to some extent. Contrary to what most creationists think, evolution is not got anything to do with where we are in life, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. And evolution also has got nothing to do with the origin of the universe. Those are two distinct scientific, these are scientific questions. I'm not denying that they are scientific questions, they're just not evolutionary questions. And also, one of the tenets of evolutionary biology is that the explanation of for the diversity of life on Earth, which is what we're interested in here tonight, does not require intelligent design. That does not mean that there is no God, which is why I said a minute ago that I'm not here to convince anybody about the existence or inexistence of God. I'm just saying that a natural explanation of diversity of life is possible, and which is what science is about. So let's start on the first count, which is evolution as a change in gene frequencies. That molecule over there is a sample of DNA, which is what your genes and everybody else's genes are made of. The evidence and the theory for the fact that evolution does occur in the sense that genes do change in frequency in major populations comes from, the theory comes from population genetics, which is a highly mathematical branch of evolutionary biology. It has been, people have been publishing in that area for the last about 100 years or so. The empirical evidence comes from molecular biology, especially modern molecular biology, provides you evidence of changes in gene frequencies in populations under your very nose that happen as they appear. Examples are innumerable, and they cover every known kind of organism. There are studies in both theoretical population genetics and empirical molecular biology on viruses, bacteria, plants, fungi, animals, including mammals, primates, and humans themselves. One of the branches of molecular evolution and biology deals with the evolution of man or humans. Now, let's get into an example, a specific example. As I said, I cannot give too much information into a 30-minute format, and I wouldn't want to otherwise, but let's get into a couple of specific examples so you get a flavor of what evolution biology actually do. And I hope you get the idea that evolution biology don't go out there trying to convince people that there's a God. What we do is this. One of the things that we study is, for example, the evolution of the HIV virus. Now, you all know that the HIV virus causes a disease of the immune system. It is very common among vertebrates. In fact, it's found among dolphins as well. Something like the HIV virus is found among dolphins, which is why there's that pretty picture of a dolphin out there. There are two major kinds of human HIV virus, and one of them, so-called HIV-1 and HIV-2, I guess the person who discovered them wasn't too much into imaginative names. But HIV-1 evolved from chimp virus and attacked human populations in the 1940s. You can study that both from molecular biology and from epidemiological studies. And then it spread through Europe in the 1970s. We actually know the person who brought it to Europe. There's a Swedish or a Norwegian settler who had been working in Africa for the previous decade or so. And he went back there, and that he was the person who was infected. All European forms of HIV are derived from that particular individual. And the reason you can tell that is because of the tools that molecular evolutionary biology has available. As you also probably know, AIDS is very difficult to cure. And the reasons, in order to understand the reasons, you have to understand some evolutionary biology. If evolutionary biology tells you why is it that HIV is so difficult to cure. For one thing, the virus, which you're seeing over here, attacking a human cell, that's a human lymphocyte cell, a human immune system cell. The virus mutates very rapidly. Mutations are one of the two fundamental components of evolution. Evolution works with two fundamental processes. One is mutation, which is random, and the other one is natural selection, which is not random. Well, mutations in the HIV virus occur very rapidly, which is one of the reasons that it's very difficult to find a cure. Because it literally mutates under your very nose, since it has a very rapid lifespan. The other one is the environment. The environment of an HIV virus is very complex because it depends on the sexual behavior of individuals, which are very complex and varied across the world. And in fact, they are so varied that there are different kinds of HIV virus that are adapted to exploit one kind of sexual behavior or another. All of this is perfectly understandable in terms of evolution. What you're looking at from the 1940s on is the evolution of a new form of virus and how it spread through populations and adapt to new conditions. This is exactly what evolutionary biology would predict. Now what about the idea of evolution as the center of modification, which was Darwin's original definition of evolution. So that's what he meant. He wasn't aware of this particular kind of diagram, but this is a diagram of the evolution of the Ceratopsians. The Ceratopsians are the three-horned dinosaurs, which are very common in museums, in paleontological museums all over the world. That's what we know right now, as of now, of the evolution of Ceratopsians. These are the different forms and how they are related to each other. You can see, incidentally, there are a lot of intermediate forms, which is another one of the myths of creation, that the intermediate forms are not there. Well, evolution is the center of modification, that is, as this kind of diagram that I'm showing here, it started by a variety of disciplines, including comparative anatomy and paleontology. And the evidence for this evolution by descent comes from a variety of disciplines, from organisms and morphology, from the study of the physiology of the organism, from the developmental biology of the organism. All of these different pieces of information, which of course I don't have time to get into any detail at this point, do fit very well with each other, and they represent the general evolutionary explanation of how life actually emerges. There's also, of course, evidence from the fossil record, and what you're looking at here is the evidence from the fossil record, or part of the evidence from the fossil record. I'll show you a few other pieces of evidence from the fossil record in a minute. But this is what evolutionary biologists mean by descent from modification. Let me give a specific example. Like in the case of the HIV virus for molecular evolution, let me give you a specific example in the case of descent and modification. One of the best known examples of descent and modification that we have come to understand in the last few years is the evolution of whales, which is sort of summarized over here. These are the actual skeletons that have been found in the fossil record. These are the actual whales, the currently living whales. There are two major kinds of whales, the sperm whales and the right whales. It's over here. So the baleen whales are one kind and the toothed whales are the other kind. These are some of the intermediate in the fossil record, and this is a reconstruction of what these Indian might look like. Well, how do we know? Because we have a bunch of the intermediates. Of course, we don't have the actual animals, so these pictures we're looking at too. It's not what we have. What we have is the skeleton of that creature. The evolution of whales started about 55 million years ago with some animals of this kind, which are called megamygids. These were hyena-like creatures. They were scavengers and fish hunters. And if you want to find something today that essentially has the same ecological niche, you would have to look no further than bears. Bears have actually a habit way of living that's pretty similar to what the Mesonites would have had 55 million years ago. Then there is a large number of intermediate forms, which have always been discovered in the last few years. Until a few years ago, I wouldn't have been able to tell you the story about the evolution of whales because we didn't know anything about the evolution of whales. 53 million years ago, it is only a couple of million years after the animal that I just showed you, and that's nothing in geological terms, it's a blink of an eye. Another animal appeared called Hymalaeosiris. It lived in freshwater in the sea. If you wait another 3 million years, you have Pachycephalus, which lived on both land and water. And then you have this guy right here, Ambulocephalus, which appeared between 45 and 50 million years ago. It had very reduced limbs, and you can see already that it looks much more similar to what today is our marine mammals than to the animal that I showed you a minute ago. In fact, it looks pretty much, and it had the same kind of habit, it had probably the same kind of habit, the same kind of
lifestyle, I'll say a sea lion. So if you want to see what an intermediate form will look like actually today, you have to go to the zoo and look at these kind of animals live. Of course, I'm not saying that a sea lion is an intermediate between whales and whale insects, but it looks like what an intermediate would have been. A little later on, 25 to 40 million years ago, we have this fellow, Basilosaurus, and a variety of other species of which we have found the fossils. And this thing really has extremely reduced limbs, and it really had a completely marine habit. We know that because it's found only in sediments that accumulate under marine conditions, not under fresh water. So, we actually know from combining these two kinds of information, the fossil information about evolution of whales by the sand, and the molecular biology of whales, that in fact whales are fairly closely related to hippos, which are these animals that we're coming in here, as the hippo and there's the whale. They're very closely related, meaning that they shared a common ancestor, last common ancestor, only about 55 million years ago. That's not that long ago. They both swim before walking. Obviously, the whales never walk, but the hippos do swim before walking. They nurse their young underwater. Their testicles remain inside the body, like in the case of whales. They are hairless, like in the case of whales, because hair is not very useful underwater. And they don't sweat, again, for the same reason. It's not very useful to sweat underwater, so they don't have fillings to sweat. The third point that I wanted to make was that evolution is not a theory of the origin of life. The origin of life is sometimes caricatured as this thing right here. This is the primordial soup. That's my version of the primordial soup. The idea that there was this kind of rock, complex organic compound that somehow gave origin to life on Earth. The may or may not have been the case. There are several alternative views on the origin of life. But my point that I want to make tonight is that evolution has nothing to do with the origin of life. The reason for that is because evolution requires what is called heritable variation for nature selection to act. Before there were living organisms, by definition, there was no heritable variation. There was no genetic variation of these organisms because organisms were not there to begin with. So the transition between the non-living and the living is not really a matter of evolutionary biology at all. It is a matter of physical chemistry, or the interface between physical chemistry and biology. In fact, most of the people that work on the origin of life, and it is a very active field of research, there are several people that are interested in this. Most of those people are actually biophysicists or chemists, not biologists, for the good reason that there is nothing really that an evolutionary biologist can say one way or the other about the origin of life. It's just a different problem. Now, that doesn't mean that the origin of life is not a scientific problem. Of course it is. It's a pretty tough problem because it's something that happened probably only once and probably a long time ago. So, and of course, there's very little or nothing in the fossil record that can help us to figure it out. So it is a very tough problem. But there are different ways of approaching it. Certainly not going to give you the answer tonight. For one thing, it's because nobody knows the answer. For the other thing, is because it will require a separate lecture just for that. But one of the clues is coming from these kind of pictures and this kind of theory. There's a theory in a branch of mathematics now that's called complexity theory, which deals with the emergence of complex systems. And one of the things that this complexity theory explains is the emergence of these complex systems. You can't see much because this is a satellite picture taken at very low resolution, but those are the things that you're looking at there are convective cells that form spontaneously in the upper atmosphere. There is no way to explain these complex natural phenomena unless you allow for what's called the emergent property of the interaction of the molecules that make up these cells. Well, complexity theory explains how these things originate, and complexity theory is currently our best bet to explain the emergence of another complex system, which is life on Earth. So people are working on it. I might get back to you on that, in a few minutes. The fourth point that I wanted to make was that evolution is not a theory about the origin of the universe. The universe evolved, or you hear that the universe has evolved or is evolving, but it evolves only in a very general sense, in the sense of change through time. Well, change through time is not what evolutionary biologists consider evolution. There is no selection, no mutation. No process equivalent to mutation in the formation of universes. And there is no natural selection that we know of, at least, in the origin of universes. So those are really little anomalies. Now, we do know something about the origin of the universe. Again, this is some of the empirical evidence. This is a beautiful picture from the Hubble Space Telescope. These things, which are called probable galaxies, these are the building blocks of galaxies. These are very far away, and they existed a long time ago. The only reason we can see them now is because light takes several hundred million years to come up to us from them. So we actually can peek at what was happening directly by telescopic observation, what was happening millions of years, or tens of millions of years after the origin of the universe. There's also an interesting set of theoretical research that actually addresses the origin of the universe. There are two major branches of modern physics that are trying to explain this kind of phenomenon. One is the general theory of relativity proposed by Einstein at the beginning of the century. And the other one is quantum mechanics, and Einstein actually never could quite accept because it just didn't fit his view of the world, and which was developed, ironically, based on Einstein's own research. Well, these two pieces of information are actually coming together in the 21st century in what physicists are now calling superstrings theory. Superstrings theory is, among other things, is one of our best bets to explain how the universe originated and why the universe that we live in is the way we observe it. I can give you plenty of references if you want to learn about superstrings theory. It's an extremely complicated branch of mathematics, but it is a fascinating enterprise. Now, after I thought of all of this, and I told you, well, evolution is not about this, and it's not about that. Well, does that mean that evolution failed if it cannot answer what creationists call the origin question? So if evolution cannot tell you how life originated, or how the universe originated, isn't that a failure of evolutionary biology? From what I've told you so far, you should have realized that that's not the case, because that little is talking apple and oranges. Or if you want to use a different metaphor, it's like understanding a baseball game applying the rules of basketball. It just doesn't work that way. It's like asking theoretical physicists to explain evolution biology. Well, theoretical physicists wouldn't know where to begin with, because evolution biology has very little to do with quantum mechanics. These are valid scientific questions, but they cannot be held against evolution biology. So, well, you haven't explained the origin of life, therefore, what are you talking about? It just doesn't work that way. The last point I want to make before concluding the opening statement is to address the question of, well, does the variety of life on Earth require intelligent design? Which is, of course, why most people that are here tonight are interested in. And intelligent design, of course, can be a variety of things. Creationists don't necessarily agree on what intelligent design is to begin with. Some of them think of a certain kind of God. Some of them actually think of, believe it or not, very smart extraterrestrials, a la Star Trek. But the question is, there are logical objections to the application of intelligent design theory to the explanation of life on Earth. One is that it violates what it's called Occam's razor. Occam's razor, which was proposed by William of Ockham in the 13th century, is actually the idea that you should avoid unnecessary hypotheses in order to explain something. What is an unnecessary hypothesis? Well, for example, I can explain why you're looking at this presentation based on the laws of physics. Based on what little I know about physics, I can tell you that there are some electrons that are coming here from my computer and they go down here, falling all the way up there, back to the projector, and the projector generates an image of this projector. I can explain both with optics and philosophical physics what's happening. I could also say, on top of that, there is a tiny little green monster which is actually taking these images from here and bringing them directly up there. That's possible. You would have to ask me, first of all, if it is invisible, how do you know that it's green, for one thing. But do I need that kind of explanation? No, I don't. That doesn't mean that there is no little green monster bringing my little electrons all the way to the image. It just is that I don't need that explanation. And it's not a good scientific theory. The reason for that is because you can come up with an infinite number of alternative stories that would all be equally unfalsifiable. There would be no way to test if they're right or not. And it would be all equally redundant. That's what Occam's razor does, and that's what creationism does with evolution. The second thing that creationism does with respect to evolution is it violates something that is sometimes called Hume's dictum. Hume didn't say exactly along these lines, I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially he said that when you want me to believe about extraordinary claims, you have to provide extraordinary evidence. But the more extraordinary the claim is, the more extraordinary the evidence has to be. Let me give you an example. Suppose a friend of yours tells you, just 5 minutes ago, I walked across the street and went to the Coke machine and got a Coke. Well, you wouldn't require any evidence from that kind of statement, because that's a fairly believable evidence statement. It may or may not be true. I mean, I might not have walked over there, but nevertheless, it doesn't really tickle your curiosity that much. But what if that person says, I just disappeared from the front of this building and I materialized on the other side of the street and got my coat and then rematerialized back? Now you've got my attention. And now the question is, what kind of evidence do you have that you can actually materialize and dematerialize at will? Why? Because that's a fairly extraordinary claim. And if you want me to believe that fairly extraordinary claim, you have to provide me fairly extraordinary evidence. So the difference between evolutionary creation is that we have a pretty good explanation, by no means perfect, but a pretty good explanation, scientific and nature explanation, of how life on Earth diversified. If you want me to believe otherwise, and if you want to believe that there was a direct intervention of a supernatural being, of which we have no evidence and no way to tangibly check what that supernatural thing is. Well, then the burden for instance is on the other side, which is what I just said. Now, why do I say this? Because there are a couple of things about, a couple of basic observations you can make about life on Earth, which are really directed against any explanation on intelligent design. For one thing, the story of life on Earth is very idiosyncratic. It indicates, therefore, what scientists call contingency and necessity. Contingency is the hazard, a series of hazard events that have no particular reason to happen one way or another, or at one time or another. And then necessity is nature selection. That is, the organisms that survive tend to be the ones that have the most perfect progeny. Well, one big example of contingency is the extinction of the dinosaurs. They got bad luck that day, 65 million years ago, when a meteor struck the Earth and wiped them out. They killed 100,000 other species. There's no reason why that could happen. One should have happened one way or the other, just did. There's some speculation, which is kind of interesting to think about, that if it didn't happen, dinosaurs would have evolved something like consciousness, and there would be a dinosaur here talking to you guys and trying to explain why it's with all these little mammals around here and made it beyond the stage of rats. Which is what mammals wear when the dinosaurs went extinct. It is possible that one of the reasons you're here tonight, to enjoy this talk, is because the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. But that was certainly a matter of contingency. The other kind of observation, which actually Darwin already made, is that organisms, contrary to what creationists would make you believe, are not well designed at all. In fact, they're fairly badly designed. One of the best examples of badly designed organisms is actually the eye. Human eye is usually brought up as an example of extremely complicated and very well-designed structure. Well, it is extremely complicated. It has been designed by natural selection over hundreds of millions of years. And it works pretty well, though not perfectly, obviously, because right now I see an ocean of more or less undifferentiated people, if I take these off. So it's not perfect. But it's not perfect in a more fundamental way. For example, not many people realize that the human eye has blood vessels right in front of it, okay, in front of the radio, instead of where a good engineer would put them, which is behind. One of the things that does is it causes all sorts of vision problems, including the fact that you have a blind spot. Now, could it be designed better? Yes. Has it been designed better? Yes. If you look at the eye of squids or octopuses or animals of that sort, actually they have the blood vessels in the back, not in the front. So I will conclude that either there was no intelligent designer and squids just got luckier than human beings, or the intelligent designer liked human beings much better squids much better than human beings, which is possible. Now, thank you. I will actually not be here. This is my last slide for the introductory statement. If you have not followed all that I said, or if you would like to learn more, that is the webpage where this thing is back there. It's called fpbio.edu/skeptic. I will review this later on during the rebuttal. As I said, it's quite difficult for people that are flooded with a lot of information all at once. actually to be able not to follow the whole thing, that happens to be right. And so the presentation is up there for anybody to see. Now the question is, what is the evidence? Let me present you one little game. Suppose that you were looking at these pictures. Would you be able, without hesitation, to pick a human being as different from common ancestors of human beings or from other species of primates? In some cases it might be easy, but in some cases it might be a little bit difficult. It's not that easy. Here's the human being, it's down here. But look, Homo habilis and Erectus skulls look pretty much very similar, and those are two of our ancestors. And anything, in fact, within this line is not that different. It's a clearly variation in the same theme. You can tell an Australopithecus, for example, from any of the Homos, because an Australopithecus was a much different kind of animal, although it is in the line, direct line of descent of human beings. But the point is, can you really look at a picture like that and think that you are completely different from anything else that is up there other than this? You have the same bones, they're organized in the same way, you have the same kind of chemical substances in the blood, you're made of the same proteins, of the same kind of DNA. In fact, the difference in DNA between human and chimp on average is only about 2%. Can any rational person look at something like that and say, no, I really don't think that we're made of the same thing, we're completely different things, we're completely independent, we have no relationship whatsoever. That's what evolution tells you. You do have a relationship. Like it or not, I mean, I don't particularly enjoy being the descendant of this little fellow over here, but nevertheless, that is our best guess to what actually really happened. Thank you very much.
The blood vessels are the body's last defense against ultraviolet light.
not because live in the water. And water stops UV light. So they don't need the blood vessels in front, they need them behind so they can see better in low light conditions. Now, if you believe an octopus has a better eye, I will pay to have yours swapped with an octopus any time. You are blind in a few days. You need the blood vessels in front. So, science is things that we can observe, things that we can test or demonstrate. A theory is a speculative plan, a formulation of underlying principles of certain observed phenomena which has been observed to some degree. Principles of an art or science rather than its practice or a conjecture or a guess. Now, a myth is a traditional story serving to explain some phenomena. I contend that evolution is a myth. It is not observable. There's no observable evidence. We are so convinced there's no evidence for evolution, we offer $250 million to our ministry. I don't have the money, but a rich friend of mine does. $250 million for anybody with any real scientific evidence for evolution. It is nothing but mythology that students are all paying to be taught. Okay, it's a fictitious story, a person or a thing, according to the dictionary. This fellow said, evolution and the myth of creationism, I need to object to. Once again, as I've done 50-some times, when he introduced the debate, they always say, it is evolution versus creationism. If anything isn't ism, it is evolutionism, not creationism. If you're going to call one ism, they both should be isms, okay? So it's evolution versus creation, or evolutionism versus creation. Here's the problem with this title. They put the ism on creation, and it should be on evolution. Myth also applies to evolution, and the facts supporting evolution have all been disproven or misinterpreted. And I took curious notes on all the things he was giving us evidence for evolution, and if we had time to go point by point, we could refute all of those very easily. You may want to watch my 15-hour seminar where I do just that, videotape up there. Many evolutionists will not debate against creationists, and I really appreciate Dr. Bigliucci debating Wayne Gibbs 4 times and me now for the 2nd time. I can tell you, it is very difficult to find an opponent. I would not want to defend the idea that we all came from a rock. I don't know why anybody would either, but some people, it is hard to find an opponent for this. They prefer to be in front of their students where they have the academic advantage and psychological advantage. They don't like to take on creationists, and they give all sorts of reasons for this. Dr. Eugenia Scott, I debated one time on the radio, I'm glad to do it again. She said, you should not debate creationists because they present a flood of points you don't have time to refute. Called the Gish Gallop is what they've dubbed it. The main case should give 50 points and you don't have time to refute it. Well, that's my whole point. I'd rather do this point by point. And I asked you before if you'd like to do that. And you said, no, you'd rather have 30 minutes and me take 30 minutes. Okay, we can do it this way. But during Q&A, then we can just go point by point until the point is finished. Okay? They get 100% class time for all the students, 6 hours a day, all year, for 12 to 20 years, without getting any evidence against their theory, or for creation. So I think, yes, we do give a flood of points, because we only get a short amount of time to get the job done. That does not prove the flood of points is wrong, of course, it's just it's a cop-out saying they give too many points to refute. That is not an answer at all. They say they attract more creationist supporters than scientists. Well, everyone's welcome to come tonight. We're doing this on your university. I'll be glad to go to any university, anytime, at my expense, and debate against evolution. I think students need to hear the other side. And who gets to decide who's a scientist, anyway? See, in the evolutionist mind, if you don't believe in evolution, you're not a scientist, and therefore, all scientists believe in evolution. You don't need to be a genius to figure out we have a little problem there, if you're going to let them define who is a scientist. And the public, Jeannie Scott says, the public rarely has the background to understand the complex answers. Let me translate that for you. We're smart and you're dumb. If you don't believe in evolution. That's how that translates. Anybody else get that translation out of it when you read it? That's what I got out of it. They're going to say the creationists like debates because it will ensure them a bigger crowd than if they spoke alone at some church. I would challenge you, Dr. Bigliucci, or any other evolutionist, I want you to schedule a meeting to speak on evolution when there's no debate, when there's nobody, no controversy, and no students are required to come as part of the grade, and see how many folks show up. Just try that sometime. I average over 1,000 a week in churches I speak at, and it's a church for 15,000. People come, people flock for this topic, okay? So nobody's forced to come to my seminars like they are at the university where they have to go to some class, to get the grade or something like that. So schedule a voluntary meeting and see how many folks come. I think you'll be surprised. Here's how science is supposed to work. You're supposed to observe the universe. You're supposed to create a hypothesis or a theory to explain what happened. He's supposed to present evidence. And I like what you said about Hume's, Hume's dictum. Yeah, like Aristotle said. If you have an extraordinary point, you need to claim he didn't have some extraordinary evidence. And I think to claim that we all came to rock 4.6 billion years ago is an extraordinary claim. And that would require some extraordinary evidence before I'm going to cheerfully volunteer to let my tax dollars pay to have that talk to all the students in the school system. And if the theory cannot be, there can be falsified, you should throw it out and go back to get a new one, new theory. If you cannot falsify it, possibly you have the right theory. And then you keep testing and testing, and somebody someday decides it is a law, like the law of gravity. That's how it's supposed to work. Okay, the creationists have a theory, and the evolutionists have a theory. They call theirs a theory. So let's subject it to the scientific method. What observations do we have to support the idea that any animal ever changed into another kind of animal? You showed some pictures up there of the whale, and I'd love to spend an hour getting into the evolution of the whale. And I'd like you to show real, honest pictures of what they actually found, not the reconstructed idea of what it might have looked like. And I think the average audience would be surprised at how little evidence there is. And plus, if you find a bone in the dirt, all you know is it died. You don't even know where it died. You just know where it ended up getting buried, that's all. That's all you know. And you sure don't know that it had any kids. And you don't know that, and you definitely don't know that it had different kids. And why do the evolutionists claim the bones in the dirt can do something the animals today cannot do? The bones in the dirt could produce different kinds of offspring, but the animals today cannot. I mean, if a bear is turning into a whale, the bears are still having babies. Let's see it happen again. Only let's watch it this time. And what mechanism has been observed to bring about these incredible changes that they talk about? And are there any other explanations for how these limited changes can happen? This textbook says the Colorado River has cut through layer upon layer of rock over millions of years. Now, hold on just a second. Let me explain something that every science student ought to learn in third grade, okay? There are facts. It is a fact Grand Canyon exists. Then there are interpretations of that fact. The creationists have an interpretation, and the evolutionists have an interpretation. The creationist says it formed quickly by lots of water over a little bit of time. The evolutionist says it formed slowly by a little bit of water over lots of time. Now the fact is the canyon exists. Whose interpretation is right? That's not part of the fact. That's just the interpretation of the fact. It's a fact the earth has many layers of sediment. No argument on me. I've seen it. I've been to, 26 countries and all 50 states and 7 Canadian provinces, and I've seen lots of Grand Canyon and lots of canyons, climbed on 40 volcanoes. There's no question the earth has lots of layers. How did they get there? Well, the creationist says these layers are from the flood of Noah. The evolutionist says each layer represents millions of years. Now, what happens, the students are often taught that this line really doesn't exist, and they know that the evolutionist interpretation is part of the fact column. And that is where the tragedy comes in. No, that line definitely does exist, okay? And your interpretation of the fact is not part of the fact. I'll show you. If you built a dam across Grand Canyon, a huge lake would form behind it. Actually, Grand Canyon is a breached dam. As anybody that studies the topic will know, the snow line on that picture kind of tells the story. In between those two red lines is snow, the white part, and that is a higher elevation. Grand Canyon is cut across the middle of a wrinkle called the Kaibab Uplift. It's like a long range or ridge of a mountain range, like wrinkling a piece of carpet, a fold in the carpet. Okay. The top of this Kaibab Uplift is about 7,000 or 8,000 feet above sea level. The river enters the canyon 2,800 feet above sea level. Now, that's interesting. The river flows downhill. All known rivers flow downhill. Okay? As the river is flowing downhill, the ground is rising up. Now, let's just study the scientific observations here, okay? The top of the canyon is higher than the bottom. Anybody disagree? Just stop being done, okay? The river runs through the bottom. Still with me? The top is higher than where the river enters the canyon, by 4,000 feet. Rivers don't flow uphill. There is no delta. Where is the mud that washed out? That river did not make that canyon. Now, it's a fact Grand Canyon exists, but the evolutionist interpretation
that happened slowly over millions of years does not stand up to scientific scrutiny. Their interpretation is falsified. That river did not make that canyon, I'm sorry. If you would like millions of years for your frog to turn into a prince, I can understand why you would need that, but you can't have it, at least you can't use Grand Canyon as evidence for it. The creationist interpretation says, 6,000 years ago or so, God made everything in 6 days. And that explains why we have so many millions of symbiosis relationships. Animals and plants were created, designed for each other, and created within a day or so of each other. That works just great. If you want them to evolve separately and slowly over millions of years, you have a multitude of problems that come in, which are just glossed over by the evolutionists. It amazes me how they can grossly oversimplify life and oversimplify the complexity of living things and just assume, well, that's what happened because here we are. That's not evident. Charles Darwin, fresh out of Bible college at age 22, sailed around the world on board the Beagle in 1831. As he sailed around, Charlie came to the Galapagos Islands and he noticed there were 14 varieties of finches on these islands. He studied them carefully. Charlie hated birds. He liked worms. And he thought it was mean for birds to eat worms, so he shot all the birds he could because it was kind of hard on the worms getting chewed up, he thought. And so he really was an unusual fellow. But he did raise pigeons, kind of a strange guy. He married his first cousin, Emma Wedgwood, who's one I'll live on Charlie if you'd like. But anyway, Charlie noticed there were 14 varieties of finches. He concluded that all these finches had a common ancestor. I bet you're right, Charlie. It was a bird. And then he said in his book on page 170, and I've got the book there. I guess I didn't bring my stuff in. It's in the car. I'll set it tomorrow. I'm speaking to church in Powell. Charlie said in his book, "It is a truly wonderful fact that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other." Well, now hold on just a minute. You count 14 varieties of finches, and then you conclude that finches and bananas are related? I think that's a little bit of a stretch from the observation, don't you think? Isn't that what he's saying? Birds and bananas are related? Am I reading that wrong? That's what he said. Everything is related, based on 14 kinds of birds. No, Charlie. See, what Charlie observed is often called microevolution. Now, microevolution is a lousy term. I don't like it, but everybody uses it, so we're stuck with it. And Dr. Pidditch has spent a lot of his time trying to deflect what I'm about to say here. Microevolution is a fact of science, folks. It happens. It is observable. Dogs produce a variety of dogs. Big dogs, little dogs, probably have a common ancestor. Dog. And big roses and little roses and yellow roses and white roses and red roses and pink roses probably have a common ancestor. Rose. See, microevolution is observed. This word evolution really does have six different meanings or stages or levels, whatever you want to call it. Cosmic evolution is the big bang. Some evolutionists say this is not part of the argument about evolution. Okay. Well, if it's really not part of the argument about evolution, then why don't you help me get it out of the books? Because I guarantee the biology books used in this campus that you teach from have this included in with the books on evolution. It starts off with statements like that. Take it out of the books if it's not part of the subject, okay? This book has it for a high school student. 18, 20 billion years ago, well, let's get that out of the books. Science books ought to teach science, okay? Then they're going to say, the second one would be chemical evolution. According to the Big Bang, hydrogen was produced and a little bit of helium. Well, there are 92 different, 107 different elements if you count the synthetic ones. How did they evolve? This is not talked about much, but chemicals would have to evolve, folks. I mean, that's a long, each molecule is, or chemical is incredibly complicated. Just the right number of protons and electrons and neutrons, and it's just really pretty interesting. They are so complex. They don't talk about that much, but there would have to be some chemical evolution. They would have to have stellar and planetary evolution. How did the stars evolve? If evolution is true, star births should equal star deaths. We see stars dying all the time with supernovas and novas. Nobody's ever proven one star birth. And yet there's enough stars out there that everybody on Earth can own 2 trillion of them to themselves. Where's the star births going on? Nobody's ever proven one. They say, well, in Crab Nebula, there's a bright spot. We think there's a star being born. Well, it might be the dust is clearing and you're seeing one that was back behind it. And one star forming is not how, explaining how we got all the zillions of them up there. One evolutionist told me, he said, we've calculated that 20 stars explode orbit near each other, it'll create the energy to create a star. Oh, that's brilliant. You've got to lose 20 to gain one. You should run for Congress, man. You can help those guys borrow their way out of debt. Stetzel says, as Earth formed, the surface was like the moon. Earth's surface was hot, and there were large pools of bubbling lava. Oceans formed as it rained on the rocks for millions of years. Yes, boys and girls, millions of years of torrential rains created the oceans. And swirling in the waters of the oceans is a bubbling broth of complex chemicals. Progress from a complex chemical soup to a living organism is very slow. Oh, I guess it is. It's totally stopped. Doesn't happen at all. That's not slow, is it? This guy says in a college textbook, the first self-replicating systems must have emerged in this organic soup. Now, if this is not part of the argument about evolution, then get it out of the course you teach on evolutionary biology. See, students are being deceived by the meaning of this word evolution. Then we have to have organic evolution, the origin of life. Ultimately, the evolutionist has to believe in spontaneous generation, which was proven wrong for the last few centuries. All sorts of folks have proven it doesn't happen. Go read the reports of Francisco Reddy and Louis Pasteur, and you'll see spontaneous generation doesn't happen. But the evolutionist has no other choice. They'll say it had to happen because we're here. Oh, that's brilliant logic, all right. See, according to the theory, if we simplify here, you got 20 billion years ago, Big Bang, and then 4.6 billion years ago, the Earth cools down, and 3 billion years ago, life appears in the soup. And this early life form finds somebody to marry. A pretty good trick, of course, and something to eat, and very slowly evolves into everything we see today, from elephants to bananas and humans, all came from this soup. That's what the theory says. I mean, I'm not making it up. It's their theory. I didn't make it up. Cosmic chemical and stellar evolution would take place first, and then we'd have organic evolution, origin of life, and then we'd have macroevolution, changing from one kind of animal into a totally different kind of animal. Those are the first few steps of evolution, the first five of the six that I have there, and those aren't talked about much. They try to focus the attention on variations within living kinds right there. And that's what Dr. Pigliucci is trying to do tonight. He's trying to show us variations within the same kind of plant or animal, and draw attention away from the first five major steps that would have had to take place in order for this sixth one to even be able to start happening. So, microevolution, though it's a lousy term, is science. Variations happen within the same kind of animal. You admit the first four steps are not proven and are not part of science, not part of evolution at least, then why don't you help them get them out of the books used on this campus? How many students in this campus right here? Would you report to me in about 3 or 4 months and tell me how much effort he has put into getting those out of the textbooks, please? Okay? Let me know. See, the textbook here says, mammals, birds, and crocodiles have a common ancestor. Now, this is pure speculation. This is propaganda, Soviet style. That's not science. All those trees of life that are branches of our ancestors is a lot of nonsense. Even Mary Leakey admits that. She believes in evolution. British Museum of Natural History has a director called Colin Patterson. He was asked, Luther Sunderland read Patterson's book about evolution. Patterson wrote a book about evolution. Sunderland read it and said, Mr. Patterson, I read your book about evolution, but I noticed you never showed any missing links. Why didn't you show us any missing links? Patterson wrote back and said, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil. Now, Dr. Pigliucci claims there is a multitude of intermediate fossils. Dr. Colin Patterson, who has his hands on the largest fossil collection in the world, says there isn't one. Somebody is mistaken here, folks. Even Stephen Gould, the communist professor at Harvard, says the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks are not from the evidence of fossils. They make up these trees. It's based on imagination. It doesn't happen. It's true, dogs produce a variety of dogs. No argument out of me. That happens. Anybody gets some really wild, wild dogs. I mean, really bizarre variations. But you're always going to get a dog. Nobody's ever seen a dog produce a non-dog. And if it did, who would it marry? Think about it. You might get a big dog or a little dog, but you're always going to get a dog. And it could be the dog, the wolf, and the coyote have a common ancestor. I would not argue about that. But they're still the same kind of animal. Let's see if we can find the youngest kid in the room here. Anybody here under seven? How old is he? Six and a half. What's your name? What? Joshua? Joshua, up here on the screen, I have a dog, a wolf, a coyote, and a banana. Which one is not like the others? The banana! Let's give him a hand. It could be that the horse and the zebra have a common ancestor. I wouldn't argue about that. Stand back and look at them. They're the same kind of animal. That doesn't do a horse and a banana are related, folks. What happens? Students are asked to make a giant leap of faith and logic, totally in the absence of any scientific evidence, to believe in macroevolution, which says the dog and the rose have a common ancestor. If you go back far enough time, and it was a rock. That's based on a fantasy, based upon imagination. See, this is never talked about. This one's not talked about much. This one is talked about a little bit, but they really focus on microevolution or variations within the same kind. And that's all it is a variation. We don't argue about that. That happens. The rest is assumed. They try to sneak them in as if it's a package deal. Well, if you believe in evolution, you have to believe in the whole thing.
You have 5 minutes, sir.
Oh, man, I'm just getting rolling. Okay. Number six of those six is true, but then five are smuggled in. Students are given one definition, like descent with modification, which is true. Even Dr. Bigliucci tonight in his slides said, evolution is a change in gene frequency over time. Now that is kind of a deceitful definition of evolution, because that's the same as I've said, the animals are going to bring forth after their kind, and you might get a gene frequency. But see, changing the gene frequency does not change the genetic complexity, and it doesn't add any new information. It doesn't make a new animal. Changing the gene frequency is like scrambling up the letters of the English alphabet. You will never get Chinese words that way. And evolution requires changing into a totally different kind, a totally new genetic information. Much of this textbook does. Evolution means a change over time. That's definition number one. This one says, evolution is defined as a change in species over time. Oh, now they've narrowed it clear down, haven't they? If you really mean species change over time, I agree, then we can all call it. It's what's implied that I don't like. See, they slip in the other definitions of evolution, like cosmic and organic, and say, then they tell the students, if you don't believe in evolution, you don't understand science. I'm sorry, I think I do understand science pretty well. I taught it 15 years. And evolution is not part of science. It is a religious worldview that is unsupported by science, and I, for one, am sick and tired of paying for it to be taught in our public school system. In advertising, it's called bait and switch. If I said, new Mercedes, $10, everybody would line up at the door to buy it. Well, when you got there, and I said, hey, actually, it's $99. Well, I baited you to come in and switch it. That's illegal. People go to jail for that. And professors ought to go to jail for baiting the students to believe in evolution with variations and then switching it midstream. Bible warns about science that is falsely so-called, and evolution is not science. It's a religious worldview, and if you want to believe in it, that's perfectly fine, but keep it at home, please. Don't bring it into a tax-supported institution. It has nothing to do with science. So what's in these books? Dr. Bigliucci gave all sorts of evidence of evolution, which we'll have to take up in the rebuttal time. How much time left? 3 minutes. I'll get a couple of minutes. Okay. Here's the evidence they use. He mentioned fossils. I was really surprised at that one. Vestigial structures he did not mention, but this is in almost every textbook. Fossil structure, molecular biology, development, DNA similarities, structure of the limbs, called homology argument, and poor design, like the eyeball. That one ought to be outgone a long time ago. The eyeball is very well designed. And the reason so many folks have glasses is probably more dietary or inherited genetic problems from, you know, when you realize you're a copy of 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 the original Adam, I think it's pretty good that we can see it all. You get a computer program and copy it, and copy the copy, and copy the copy of the copy, and copy the copy of the copy of the copy, and do that about 500 times, and then put it in your computer and tell it to run. See how it does. You have an incredibly complex gene code that is still working pretty good. And to say that we have glasses as evidence for evolution is absolutely ridiculous. Now, the fact that the eyeball is unbelievably complicated. Darwin said, if my theory was true, numberless immediate varieties must have existed. Where are these missing links? Well, David Roth of the Near American Museum of Natural History says, in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, these have not been found, yet the optimism has died hard and some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. There is some fantasy in the books used in this campus right here, things that are used to support evolution that don't, that ought to be taken out. There aren't any missing links, folks. No chain is missing. Google said, the absence of fossil evidence is an agony problem for evolution. We know the theory is true, now we just need the evidence. That's not how science works, Steve. Find a fossil in the dirt, all you know is it died, folks. That's it. That's not evidence for evolution. Fossils don't offer any evidence at all. You don't know that they have any kids. You certainly don't know that they have different kids. And just because you can arrange them in some kind of preconceived idea of what you think might have happened, that would hold up 2 seconds in a court of law. I can arrange knives and forks and spoons in order and prove they evolved from each other. Doesn't prove a thing. Each one was designed. We'll get into more in the Royal section about the embryology. He mentioned development. I was surprised that was still in there after being proven wrong 127 years ago. We'll get into that later. Thank you, sir.
So I've got some quotes from his presentation. He said, it amazes me how evolution can oversimplify. By God, it amazes me how you can oversimplify science. Listen to his tirade was one of the most simplistic versions of science I've ever heard, and I was really astonished. I mean, the writers of Star Trek get much better, not only in the details, but in the general picture. According to my physicists, biologists, astronomers, geologists, chemists, and all the others, these people that spend their lives getting PhDs and working in labs, oh, a bunch of fools. After all, it is obvious that there is something that a 70-year-old could get just in a minute. Do you smell the rat there? Isn't that really conceivable, a conceivable thing? These people are all bunch of idiots out there that are being paid. And they spend a lot of time studying to come up with things that, golly, if you just think about it for 1 second, you realize that they're wrong. I think the thing is a little more complicated than that, that you can think of it myself. And by the way, what is the problem with bananas anyway? There's a problem with bananas. Evolutionists don't say that dogs or monkeys come from bananas. That's not what we say. Now, men also consider that he has managed to talk for over 30 minutes, no, for about 30 minutes, and said nothing, not a single thing, in favor of the creationist model. He seems to be thinking that he went by default, but this is not a match, this is not a sports match, not if your opponent leaves, you're left the winner. The further of proof is on both sides, not on one. It's not because you find a couple of problems with evolution, any evolution biologist, by the way, would gladly say there are problems with evolution. I'm a professional evolution biologist. If there were no problems with evolution, if we knew everything, I would be out of a job. And that wouldn't be good. So it's in my interest that there are problems. Now he said, if the Big Bang and the origin of life are not science, why not get them out of the textbooks? Well, you didn't listen. That's not what I said. I said that Big Bang and the origin of life are not questions within evolution biology. Not that they're not science. I did say that they're science. I even proposed a couple of areas of science that are actually working on those problems. So they're not supposed to get out of textbooks. They're supposed to get into the physics textbooks and into the chemistry textbooks, respectively, not in evolution biology textbooks. And by the way, they are not in evolution biology textbooks. The origin of life is mentioned in the beginning, a few paragraphs, in some general biology books, but not in evolution and biology textbooks. Evolution biology just doesn't deal with it. I don't want to be a millionaire. Mr. Ominger proposed $150,000. I heard that it's been going higher and higher. I think the amount of money you're giving. Well, he gives this to whoever proves beyond reasonable doubt, of course, to his satisfaction, that evolution is the cause of the existence of value in the universe, which I said evolution is nothing to say about the order of the universe. The variety of life forms on Earth, that is evolution. And the fact that man is the most advanced of such life forms, I don't even know what most advanced life form actually means. There are plenty of animals that do much better on this planet than we do, so I don't understand what that word means. But anyway, I did give my evidence on all those counts. The last time we met in Atlanta a few months ago, I don't even receive a reply, let alone the money. Now, we started tall tales are very interesting. The kind of tales that you find in the following sources. One of the things, if you visit his website, is very instructive. I spent countless enjoyable minutes
For example, he believes that dinosaurs live among us. And what is the proof? Well, by golly, there is a picture of the Loch Ness Monster over there. Of course, that being the fun, and the kind of, that kind of picture you find usually things like the Weekly World News, together with a John Bennett blockbuster and a Chicago woman has three brains. You think that's what we have. He claims that that picture has not been the fun he has. He also believes that evolution has been shown to be false, because there was a link to his from US website to this kind of source. This would really be a problem with evolutionary biology. This is supposed to be a dinosaur skeleton, that's a skull, directly eating a human being. Now, if you're in front of paleontologists, you smell another rat right there. And sure enough, that was actually an apple fool. It was a hoax put up by the News from Mexican Science in recent. And they did say that was an apple fool, of course, after April. First. This number is not even on the mainstream of the creationist establishment. He mentioned Dr. Duane Dish, which I had the pleasure of dating several times, from the Institute for Creation Research. Well, Dr. Dish disagrees with several things that Mr. Darwin believes in. For example, Mr. Darwin believes that this is a real thing. This is the Palacio River in Texas, so-called human tracks, which are found right next to dinosaurs, and again, one of those proofs that dinosaurs existed at the same time as humans. Too bad, in that being the plan, they're actually dinosaur tracks, and not even the Institute for Creation Research believes this thing anymore. So I mean that, at least the last time I checked his website. I would maintain that his predictions are pretty bogus. He had on his website, and I'm not there anymore now, that the New World Order will implement the World Domination Plan by May 5, 2000. The world's population will be reduced then to 500 million people. What hasn't happened? So what kind of are we using now? Certainly not the regular one, because we still haven't seen a new world order, and the world population, unfortunately, is up to 6 billion. Now, there's a series of other preposterous statements. I'm just going to list them, because it's really difficult to disprove them. They don't require to disprove. The Smithsonian Institute killed thousands of people to amend their collection of human instruments. 5 billion people could drown in Loch Ness and nobody would notice. You have any idea of how large it is? Loch Ness is large, but not that large. 5 billion people is a lot of people. Evolution is responsible for what happened in the Indians. I mean, the Americans, the Native Americans. I don't know what that is talking about, so I had to do some research. And it turns out, actually, that the trail of tears, which is what he's referring to, the forced removal of the Cherokee, it happened in 1838. Well, the origin of species, which marks the beginning of evolution of biology, was probably in 1859. That was about, 3 years later. How can evolution be responsible for something at the time in which it happened? Evolution wasn't even around. The Great Pyramid was not built by the Egyptians. Well, go tell that to the Egyptians, because they're very proud of it. UFOs are saving way of getting around. I don't think there's any evidence that UFOs are even around, let alone fit in the use of as spaceships. And what we see in these spaceships anyway. And finally, microchips will play an important part in the mark of the beast. I don't even know what that is, but probably if you can reverse to Bill Gates, I can probably believe that. So, I think there is only one reality. One of us is profoundly mistaken, of course, you can guess who I think is profoundly mistaken. You have to decide for yourself, of course, not tonight. My main goal tonight is really to confuse your ideas as much as possible. That is the first step toward enlightenment. Once that you're not so sure of your position, then you can start going on there, go into the library, read some books, read some articles, keep thinking about these things for the rest of your life, because they're not that easy. 70-year-olds do not grasp these topics on the spot, and neither does anyone over here. But so you have these two choices. Innumerable scientists with legitimate PhDs who brought in the car, the computer, and the car on one side. Well, they tell you that you don't look for the evidence, think for yourself. But look at the evidence, the real evidence. Go to a paleontological museum, go and look at go to the zoo even. Go and look at these things and see if it doesn't make sense to think that they are ready to discover by common descent. Or you can listen to somebody who has a clear ideological agenda. Incidentally, there is a variety of ideological beliefs among scientists. You can find anything from Christians and Muslims, Buddhists, atheists, agnostics, and all of that. So there is no ideological bias, which means that science is not a religion, no matter what it is. On the other hand, there is a clear bias on the other side. Essentially, every single creationist that I know are not only belongs to a particular religion, but belongs to a particular subset of that religion. That seems to be a bias. And those are based on tall tales, and there's a very large price to pay for distortion or ignorance, and that pay, that price we're going to pay as a society every single day. The reason we teach evolution in public school is because it's good science. It is not perfect science, it is not the ultimate word on science, and as soon as we will know better, we will teach better. That's what happened in math. But the alternative in terms of creation is not only bad science, it's just not science at all. Thanks very much.
There was never a link on my website. I mentioned in a seminar one time somebody sent me an email because I was heading to a meeting, and they said, hey, did you see they found a picture of a dinosaur eating a man? I said, no, that's interesting. That night in the seminar, I said, somebody just sent me an email to say that they found a skeleton of a dinosaur eating a man. I haven't checked it out yet, but you might want to check out this website, and I gave the website verbally to that one church. The next day, somebody said, but hold on, have you checked out that website? I said, no, I just heard about it yesterday, I'll check it out today. I checked it out, and it was an April Fool. It was never on my website. Stop telling people it was, okay? All I did was one time say that I just got an email about this and I haven't checked it out yet. That's what I said. Okay. Now, let's see. Slinging mud, you know, it's easier to sling it than get it off of you. You mentioned that I made a prediction the New World Order would come May 5th of the year 2000. Now, you need to go back and watch the tape yourself, okay? I've got the documentation. I showed the cover of a book, and I said, and right beside it was the text, I don't have it with me anymore, I said some people in the New Age movement, a guy named Richard Noon, N-O-O-N-E, had written a book called May 5th, 2000, The Coming Ice Epoch. He said that by May 5th, we're going to have the population down to 500 million, and this is going to be necessary to bring in the New World Order to get rid of some of the people that are here. All I did was say, some people in the New World Order would like the population reduced to 500 million by May 5th. How many heard me say that in my seminars over the last few years? I never said it's going to happen. I said some people in the New World Order would like it to happen. Now, correct your seminar, please. Don't accuse me of saying that. I don't set any dates. I don't know when the Lord's coming back. Could be tonight. I hope so. Anyway. You mentioned that I said 5 billion people could drown in Loch Ness and nobody would notice. Now that is just simply bad journalism or a lie. I said in my seminar, 5 billion, actually 6 billion people could drown in Loch Ness and nobody would show above the surface. That is indicating the volume of that lake is big enough to hold the entire population of the world. That is not saying nobody would notice. Now correct your seminar, please, okay? I never said that, and don't accuse me of being a liar, because all I said was, and you check out the volume of Loch Ness, it will hold the bodies of 6 billion people. Figure it out for yourself, okay? The Trail of Tears, when the Cherokee Indians were moved out of this area right here in 1938, and then you mentioned, I said that what happened to the Indians is largely responsible because of the teaching of evolution. Just because Darwin's book came out in 1859, you should know of anybody who teaches courses on evolution. The evolution theory has been around long before that. Aristotle taught a form of evolution. He had his great chain of being in 400 B.C. Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, wrote most of the things that Darwin plagiarized in his own book and never gave his grandpa credit. The theory of evolution has been around since Satan in the Garden of Eden when he told Eve, you can be like God. That's what evolution says, man is evolving and progressing. And what happened to the Indians was the result of the racist philosophy that one race is better than another, and the white man's manifest destiny is to rule this continent from shore to shore, and it is directly tied in with evolution thinking that one race is better than another. The Bible says very clearly, all nations are of one blood. Read Acts chapter 17, Acts chapter 2, a couple other references talk about that. We all descended from Adam, and then later from Noah at the time of the flood. There are certainly no biblical reasons to be a racist. The Bible offers no justification for racism at all. But if you check the history, you find Adolf Hitler killed the Jews because he thought they were an inferior species. He also hated the blacks because they hadn't evolved far enough. Paul Mott killed half of his entire population because of his belief in evolution. He was a communist. He killed half the Cambodians because he wanted to help speed up the process. Adolf Hitler had decided that blonde-haired, blue-eyed Norwegians, born as Dorothy the Dog, Joshua Ebenezer, he said they were the superior race. And if we could help out, we could speed up evolution by eliminating the inferiors. Evolution and racism go hand in glove. And yes, the Trail of Tears took place in 1938, and I know the history about it real well. Sam Houston married one of the Cherokee princesses and nearly quit Congress over this issue of what they were doing to the Indians. But it was because of the evolutionary mentality. Just because Darwin's book came out years later does not prove my statement is wrong. Evolution's been around long before Darwin's book came out. He just simply gave a mechanism for how it supposedly happened. That's all. You should know that if anybody. I never said UFOs are Satan's way of getting around. Watch my videotape number 7. I'm aware you're coming up with this stuff. I have on my videotape number 7 what we call frequently asked questions. I also have it on my website. I speak 700 times a year. I get lots of questions asked to me. One of the questions, you got my notebook right there, UFOs, you can read my answer in my seminar notebook, I'll give you one of those if you'd like it. I said, I don't know what UFOs are, I've never seen one, I've never even talked to anybody who has seen one. I've read some books about the subject, I've read some interesting books about the subject. There are two theories about UFOs from a Christian perspective. One theory is that it's top secret government craft. The government works on all sorts of things they don't tell us about until, 20 years later, like, SR-71 and, the Blackbird and all these different top secret projects. And some people think, and I show the pictures of books you can read, some of these people think these might be demonic. Satan needs a way of getting it. He can only be one place at a time, whereas God can be all places at all times. And so some people think Satan might use UFOs as his means of transportation. I never said I believed it. I just said these are the two theories I'm aware of, and these are the books that talk about this. Now you go study the subject for yourself. So don't accuse me of believing something like that. I think it's getting pretty desperate when you have to resort to ad hominem attacks like you did tonight and accuse me of things, and you don't even do your research to find out if I'm right or not, or what I said. I didn't say any of those things. Now, that's why I much prefer a point-by-point discussion as opposed to have to stand up and defend myself, because we left an awful lot of things hanging about evolution theory that really ought to be discussed tonight. You mentioned in your initial presentation that development is evidence for evolution. If you are implying by that the human embryo has gill slits, I would certainly hope you're not meaning that, because that was proven wrong in 1874. If that's what you're implying, then shame on you. You ought to quit your job at the university and get an honest job picking peaches for changing tires and put the seam of these kids. You're not talking about the gill slits. You think we have evidence of evolution from development of different animals. When you get time, please expound on that, because I'd like to tear that one apart very piece by piece, very slowly. Okay? All right. I don't mind standing up and defending what I believe, but if I get falsely accused, I'm going to defend myself. I think everybody has the right to do that, and I have been falsely accused tonight. How much time do we have left?
You have
3 minutes. 3 minutes, okay. You said the eye, what you gave was interesting, what's the right word for that you said about the human eye, you said it is, number one, you said it's poorly designed, therefore there are two conclusions we can come to. Either there is no intelligent designer, or God loved octopus better than humans. This is called, I forget the term for it, maybe somebody can help me, where you give two false options, neither of which is right. Who do you want to vote for, the Democrats or the Republicans? Maybe there's another option. No. There's another option that maybe the designer designed it right and you don't understand why it's designed that way. I mean, that's the option you never even mentioned. So you give two options as if that's the only two, and what's the average student in this class going to think? The average student's going to leave that class mocking God, thinking God made a mistake by designing an eye with the blood vessels in front of the retina. The blood vessels need to be in front of the retina or you're both blind. They block UV light. You better study it out some more. You mentioned about the whale evolving. I guess I need to show you the picture of that one. I'll never get there in 3 minutes. Let me bring that up during Q&A, please, and we'll get into the whale. The whale has little bones in his pelvic region that are not used for walking on land. That simply amazes me that anybody would still teach that. It's been proven wrong so long ago. Those little bones in the whale are used necessary for muscles to attach to that are essential in reproduction. The whales cannot reproduce without those little bones and those little muscles. It has nothing to do with walking on land. Let's see. We've got 3,500 pictures in here. Okay, just a few moments to find them. Here we go. A different program. I have hyperlinks. Okay. Children's book on whales. Just imagine whales walking around. It's true. The whale has a vestigial pelvis. Vestigial pelvis in this whole biology textbook. Here are the bones they're talking about. Go to the Los Angeles Museum of Natural History and you will see those little bitty bones hanging down right there. Yep, you can walk on land, all right. There's the proof. Those bones are essential for reproduction in whales. They have nothing to do with walking on land. They never did. And all they found for the pachy, whatever it was you mentioned about the whale, was part of the jaw and a couple of teeth. How you can tell it walked at all from the jaw and a couple of teeth, I don't know. But I think if you're going to tell your students you have evidence for evolution, you should let them decide based on the real facts, not somebody's interpretation of the facts. By the time the student gets it in the textbook, it's already been digested for them. and they're told what to believe. They're not taught how to think, they're told what to believe. That's what's happening in this university. Thank you so much.
Which evolved first, the immune system or the need for it?
Good question. Let me use the first 30 seconds of my time to make one interesting point. What you heard a few minutes ago was very interesting. This is, my follow-up was obviously, and anybody that knows the meaning of those words should realize, not a dumb in my hand. A dumb in my fact is when you attack the character, not of somebody, not what somebody said. I attack what somebody said. I don't have any personal problem with Mr. Robbins' character. And by the way, all of my information, he's very well documented, so what was his mind? I haven't seen your face, I've seen your website. Now, the question about who evolves first, the chicken or the egg. That's a good question. And the way it usually happens is actually both. And by both, one means that structures evolve in response to some kind of a need, but the need also changed with the structures. In other words, the evolutionary process is an interactive process. It doesn't happen all at once, all of a sudden. Oh, now there is a problem, the environment poses a problem, and I have to come up with a solution. That's a simplistic way of thinking of evolution, which unfortunately many people get exposed to in introductory biology courses or in high school. The real thing is, the real way it works, is that the environment changes part because it is changed by the organism that lives in that environment, and vice versa, the changed environment provides an impetus for the change of the organism. So it's a co-evolutionary process, what's referred to as a co-evolutionary process. Now in terms of the immune system, I will have to give the specific references to what we know about the evolution of the immune system. So if that person can email me, I can do that. What happens in the case of the immune system is that you can look at the evolution of the immune system simply because the immune system in humans is fairly sophisticated. In fact, the primates and mammals in general is fairly sophisticated. But there are other immune systems across the animal world which are much simpler. And so if you look at actually some of the intermediate steps of the evolution of the immune systems, and that gives you a better understanding. If you're trying to understand something that is at the end of an evolutionary process, or it's the result of millions of years of evolution, you're not going to be able to understand it unless you think in terms of what kind of intermediate steps could have possibly brought an organism from here.
Dr. Hogan?
That's a good question. I think if you go back and watch the tape, anybody would agree it wasn't an ad hominem attack, it was an attack on my character. I don't know what my take on it anyway. It wasn't, I apologize, but I didn't take it that way. Okay, which you call first, the system or the need for it? This is one of millions of corollary questions that could be asked like that. Which you call first, the digestive system or the appetite? And if you have an appetite, you can't digest the food, what good does it do? And if you have a digestive system but are hungry, what good does it do? I mean, there are millions of examples like that that could be given. And I have a whole list of those type of questions in my seminar notebook of questions for evolutionists, which I would like somebody to answer. You can get one of those on the back table. By the way, my material is not copyrighted. You can get my material if you're a tightwad or a skeptic and you just want to keep your money, I won't loan it to you, I'll sell it to you. And after you're done, I'll write it back. You can send it back, get your money back, minus the cost of the shipping, whatever that is. So that's a good deal for you there. Okay, I think those millions of symbiosis-type systems or relationships are evidence that it could not have evolved.
Thank you.
It couldn't be wrong. It had to be designed. He said structure evolves
with the need. There's a question directed to you in the next 2 minutes. Explain carbon dating and why it was wrong.
2 minutes. I have about a 30-minute answer on my website. Carbon dating is very fascinating. I've studied it quite a bit. I think that people that really study the subject of carbon dating will say it's interesting, but there are too many problems with it. It does not work very well, if at all. Carbon dating, I'll just give you couple of examples in the 2 minutes here. I could explain how it works if you'd like with radiation striking nitrogen to create carbon 14. I think once a student understands how it works, all of a sudden the mystery is gone, and then they will realize, hey, this doesn't work. Okay, a couple of examples here. Living mollusk shells with carbon dated 2300 years old. Oh, they're still alive. Freshly killed seal, carbon dated 1300 years old. Shells of living snails, carbon dated 27,000 years old. One part of a mammoth, carbon dated 29,000 years old. Another part was 44,000. One part of baby Nemo was 40,000. Another part is 26,000. And the wood next to it is 9,000. The lower leg of a mammoth is 15,000 years old. The skin is 21,000. I think we have a problem here, folks. I can go for a long time. That's a dinosaur bones carbon dated. They dated less than 20,000 years old. They would not have even dated them had he told them they were dinosaur bones. Frozen dinosaur bones were found in Alaska. There's a Anthropogenesis has a book that they sell called The Great Alaskan Dinosaur Adventure. Anthropogenesis.org, you can order the book about finding frozen dinosaur bones. If they would have said they're dinosaur bones, they never would have carbon dated them because of the preconceived idea. Evolution is a great hindrance to thinking, to scientific advancement. Carbon dating is not how they date things. They didn't look at geologic dating. What am I starting? Time's up, fellas.
Easy with all those lights. I couldn't follow the argument. You looked at some of, they were going very fast. You looked at some of the sources, Reader's Digest, real good scientific source for these kind of data. Now, the problem with carbon dating is that, as any other kind of dating or any other kind of scientific technique, has a certain amount of effort, comes with a certain amount of effort, and scientists are aware of that error, and they therefore factor it in whenever they estimate the age of something. The interesting thing about dating in general, not dating man or woman, but dating in the sense of dating rocks, is that there are several different independent ways of dating the same rock or material. And amazingly, they pretty much converge on the same result. Of course, plus or minus that the amount of error, which always comes in any time you're doing empirical science. This is one of the things that is very difficult for creationists to explain. Why is it that dating things in a variety of different ways, using a variety of different methods, not just carbon dating, they always come out the same, and the oldest rocks come out to be billions of years old? You can't date the oldest rocks with carbon dating because carbon dating is valid only for fairly recent events. Carbon decays too rapidly, essentially, to do that.
Thank you. Dr. Bucci, why doesn't the theory of macroevolution contradict, second of all, thermodynamics?
It does not. No physicist, not only no biologist, but no physicist has ever claimed that the second principle of thermodynamics contradicts evolution. It certainly does not. The second principle of thermodynamics simply says that in a closed system, left to itself, the amount of disorder, which is technically known as entropy, will increase. Right? The Earth and the biosphere is not a closed system, it is an open system, because it receives both energy and material from outside, from the sun, from the rest of the solar system, so the second principle is not violated. Now, probably any other creationist will say, well, yeah, but energy by itself has never happened to help anybody. If you get zapped by a lightning, which is energy, what happens if you got involved, you die. Yes, that's very cute, you accept that, it's got nothing to do with the matter at hand. The point is, the second principle of thermodynamics applies to systems that are not the living systems. Therefore, to say that the second principle of thermodynamics is proof against evolution simply not understanding the second principle of thermodynamics. And by the way, let me make a final comment about not understanding and not studying. When someone doesn't understand something because it hasn't studied that something, if not, that person is not dumb. That's not the definition of dumb by any dictionary that I know of. It's just the definition of a person who has invented that particular or studied that particular field. I'm extremely dumb in particle physics by that definition, simply because I haven't studied particle physics. I don't consider myself a dumb person, it's just that I haven't studied that topic.
Thank you.
All right, if we have time, I'll go back and show you every slide I gave on carbon dating. None of them were from Reader's Digest. So either you are misinformed or you're lying. Now, if you're being a skeptic, if you don't believe there's a God, it's okay for you to lie. I believe there's a God, I'm going to stand up for someday. I'll put it back up on the screen. Reader's Digest? Oh, and carbon dating, I have there from the Science Magazine. Look at that. And look at the second law of thermodynamics here. It comes out of time. Okay, you assume that adding energy will overcome the second law of thermodynamics. They say the universe is a closed system, and adding energy is destructive. Quote, the universe is a closed system. Adding energy is destructive. The Japanese added lots of energy to Pearl Harbor, didn't organize a thing. We turned around and left around and added lots of energy to Japan, and didn't organize a thing with the atomic bomb. Adding energy does not organize a thing. Adding energy, the sun adds energy to the earth. It destroys the roof on your house. It'll eventually destroy the house. It'll destroy the roof on your car. It'll destroy the paint job on your car. Sunlight is destructive to everything except chlorophyll. And chlorophyll is an incredibly complex design mechanism to utilize the sunlight. So, second law of thermodynamics does apply, and evolution violates that. And if we have time, that's why I think we'll point by point set of these dumb rules.
Time's
up. See?
You may as well keep the mic for us.
Pardon?
You may as well keep the mic.
Keep the mic, okay.
Next question for you. Doesn't it take longer than 6,000 years to form a diamond?
Doesn't it take longer than 6,000 years to form a diamond? Superman does it in a few seconds. It either takes lots of time or lots of pressure. Most diamonds are found in what's called blue ground, which is in the neck of extinct volcanoes. The volcano puts an enormous amount of pressure out, as the folks who live near Mount St. Helens. Blows rocks the size of this building, several miles away. So I think probably diamonds were formed from coal near volcanoes. That's my theory on that. I don't know that anybody knows for sure how diamonds are formed. They're certainly carbon. Different crystal of carbon, like graphite and other forms of carbon are found on Earth. So my theory would be probably the diamonds formed at the time of the flood, as the fountains of the deep were broken up and the pressure was exerted from the volcanoes squirting magma through these various areas. I would be willing to discuss that and willing to study it. I don't know an answer, that's just my answer. But it either takes lots of time or lots of pressure. I think lots of pressure would do it just as well. Okay?
Can I work with that Superman thing? This is the thing that is amazing about this kind of debate. Of course, you realize here that you're getting structured by a long stretch. We're just fine things that you're very rattling in. Nobody can tell if we know what we're talking about or something. Obviously, at least one of us doesn't know what we're talking about. Now, geologists would not only claim to be scared and listen to for the formation of diamonds. But of course, we all know that geologists are a bunch of dumb people who just got a PhD in geology, and that 70-year-old would understand how diamonds are formed in 6,000 years. That's the message that we're getting tonight over and over. Next question.
Dr. Bridge, where is the empirical evidence for a chemist or physicist producing a living being from a non-living being, i.e. spontaneous generation?
Right. Okay. Before I answer that, let me get back to this recurring theme that has been brought up several times of the format of the debate. We agreed to the format of the debate weeks ago. Mr. Darwin wanted to change the debate 5 minutes before we started. That is a little bit unfair. It's not exactly a fair tactic. That is why I said we'll stick to the original debate. That's fine. You want to go point by point, I'll be very happy to do that. Now, the question was about, the origin of life from non-life. As I said before, we don't have an answer to that. We don't know how life originated. We have some theories, we have some pretty good theories. We have scant empirical evidence, and there are a lot of people, bright people, that are actually spending a lot of time working on it. Does that mean that evolution is wrong? No, it does not. As I said before, evolution has nothing to do with the origin of life. It also doesn't mean the science is wrong. I mean, people have to have this idea, which unfortunately is inculcated in their minds since by high school teachers, that science is a body of knowledge that is absolutely complete, perfect. We know everything that has been done about the universe, and therefore we're just here to explain to you. Science is an ongoing dynamic process. We are learning things and we're trying to understand things as we go. If you ask a question like that about a century ago, for example, on how do plants reproduce, the answer would have been, I don't know. Because about a century ago, nobody knew about pollen and nodules, okay? About a century later, we do know. And you ask a question like this about 120 years ago or 150 years ago about what are genes, nobody would know even what you were talking about. Nobody knew anything about the hereditary mechanisms and the hereditary deal. Today we know. So come back in 100 years and maybe I'll have an answer to the origin of life question. But I may not, so what? That is the nature of science. It's not about final answers. You find final answers only in books that you find in the National Enquirer magazine, but not in science.
All right, I solved the mystery. Science magazine, Antarctic Journal, Science Magazine, Geological Professional Paper, Geological Professional Paper, Natural History. I don't have a quote for that one. The picture is from Reader's Digest. The quote is not. I keep track of where I get my pictures from. Okay? I try to document everything just so this type of thing doesn't happen. I never said any of these quotes are from Reader's Digest.
Question on the science spontaneous generation.
I know, but see, I gotta go back and defend myself. He's gonna go and tell everybody I'm late, Superman makes diamonds. Okay? The picture was from Reader's Digest. Spontaneous generation doesn't happen. Evolutionists have to believe in it. He has no other choice. Because he doesn't want God to tell him what to do, I think, is the problem.
What mechanism limits microevolution to keep it from working on a macroevolutionary level?
What mechanism limits microevolution? Well, the Bible clearly says the animals will bring forth after their kind. The kinds, apparently, are those that originally were able to bring forth, reproduce. Now, they may have diversified to the point where they don't normally reproduce. Lions and tigers don't normally breed, but they might have got a common ancestor. They have been bred in captivity. A liger and a tiger have been produced, depending which one is the father or the mother. Even a dolphin and a whale, killer whale, were crossed, and they got a wolf at one of the zoo, I think San Diego Zoo or Hawaii Zoo, so one of them had the. Anyway, I think the mechanism is a genetic code that simply prevents them from crossing. For instance, humans have 46 chromosomes, chimpanzees have 48. So does tobacco, by the way, it has 48. That proves tobacco and chimpanzees are identical twins. I'm only bored on saying I believe that. I'm making a joke, folks, okay? I don't believe that. I think if you read in my seminar notebook, I've got a chart showing the chromosome numbers of different various animals. It's kind of a spoof on evolution, showing that it doesn't follow the predicted pattern. I think there is probably a DNA mechanism that prevents this crossing of different kinds. That's designed into it. God said the rainbow after the kind. There's never been an exception to that.
It's interesting that creationists will keep coming up with the word kind, which is not a biological term of any sort. Anytime that I ask a creationist to define exactly what does he mean by kind, I don't get an answer. How many kinds were of Noah's Ark, for example? What I guess?
Probably about 10,000, I guess.
10,000. If that is true, from 10,000 kinds we got the 7 million species of organisms that live today on Earth, you believe in a heck of a lot more evolution than I do. Biological theory between micro and macroevolution. Macroevolution is simply microevolution writ large over a very long period of time. There's no difference that anybody can figure out, and I still haven't had a patient to be able to tell me what the difference actually is. Next question.
If evolution is right, what is the purpose of life?
I don't know. I'm not a theologian, I'm not a philosopher. Well, I'm studying to become a philosopher, so maybe 4 years down the road I might give you something to that. I have no idea what the meaning of life is. And if you think you have an idea of what the meaning of life is, great. My personal preferable and preferred answer is the movie from Monty Python. That's where I get my idea. That is a joke. I don't know, biologists are not in the business of giving the meaning of life. The meaning of life is a very serious thing that every single one of us has to look for by himself or herself. If you want to do it within a religious framework, it's great. If you can find the meaning of life within that framework, I have no problem whatsoever. That doesn't have anything to do with evolutionary biologists. Evolutionary biologists, contrary to what Christians think, don't go around teaching atheism and don't go around teaching the meaning of life. You've got nothing to do with it.
To me, it'd be a moot question because evolution isn't right. So you said, if evolution is right, what's the meaning of life? Evolution isn't right, so the question is meaningless. I think there certainly is a meaning to life. I think God designed us to have fellowship with Him. I think we were made in His image, and then today, like an old coin in your pocket gets worn out, you know, you can hardly see the image anymore. I think our image is a little, you know, worn out compared to what it used to be. Some folks really don't resemble God at all. But that was, we were originally made in His image, and He designed us to have fellowship with Him. And I'd be glad to introduce you to him afterwards if you'd like to ask.
Dr. Hope, what is the difference between empirical science and origin science?
Empirical science deals with things that we can observe or test or measure or weigh. With the word empiricism, I believe you can look it up in a dictionary. I don't have that with me now. But origins really is outside the realm of science. It goes into the metaphysical. You have to believe in certain things. It's not observable or testable. You can't measure it or weigh it or prove it in the laboratory. So origins really has nothing to do with science. It should not be involved in any science classes. It should be in religion classes. There are various theories, religious theories of how the world got here. But that has nothing to do with science. So it's a shame that origins is mixed with science so much. You know, beer is often sold at football games. Beer has nothing to do with football. And origins is often put into science class, but origins is not part of science. You can tell the kids, here's the, you know, the biceps, the triceps, the deltoid, the flexors, the extenders, the radius, the ulna. And the kid says, how did we get here? We don't know. Let's just learn for the test. You don't have to get into origins because you're going to offend somebody. If you teach evolution, somebody's going to be offended. How many of you are offended when they teach evolution? Okay? If they taught creation in the schools, somebody would be offended. How many of you would be offended if they taught creation in the schools? See? It's a subject you can't please everybody, so leave it out of school.
How about if you have anything else about education in the school? That would make a lot of people very happy. The question was the origin of the difference. Right, it's the free word. That distinction that the economists have just proposed is actually a fairly naive distinction from the point of view of science. Science doesn't work that in such a simple way. There are certain limits to what science can do, by all means, there's no question about it. But some of the origin questions do fall within the limits of science. Let me give you an example. You said, well, if you can't test it empirically, you can't do experiments on it, then it's not science. Well, by that same, let me give you an analogy. By the same kind of reasoning, you would never be able to tell who murdered somebody else looking at the clues, because you were not there, you did not see it, there is no experiment you can do it, you cannot replicate it, you cannot do anything else about it. Except, you can look at fingerprints, you can look at DNA evidence, you can look at the circumstances of the crime, you can look at whether the person is suspected to do the crime actually was at that time, and so on and so forth. That is, forensic science works by clues, by indirect clues, that lead to reasonable conclusions beyond reasonable doubt. That's exactly the same way in which science works.
Dr. Kluge, can you tell us when or how plants evolve from animals, or vice versa, i.e. when did an animal or a plant give birth to the other type?
Okay. Plants did not evolve from animals. The closest group to animals, phylogenetically speaking, that is in the history of life, is actually fungi. That's not to say that a fungus all of a sudden became a mammal. That's the way of a simplistic way of putting it. It's just that they share a very distant ancestor. As far as the gland, I think the best estimate that we have at this point is about 1 billion years or 800 million years ago, less than 1 billion years ago. Now, when you think of animal in that sense, as I said, you don't think of a mammal, you don't think of an animal with skeletal human, you don't think of a worm. It's what makes it way too complicated. What you're thinking of, you'd be thinking of, are cells, which are structures, unicellular organisms, which are structured one way or the other. The unicellular organisms that gave origin eventually to the animal lineage share a most common ancestor with the same organisms, unicellular organisms, that share, that gave origin to fungi. That is not to say that fungi all of a sudden translate to human beings or bananas into mammals or humans, that sort of thing.
Okay, repeat the question, please.
Can you tell us when or how plants evolved from animals or vice versa?
When or how plants evolved from animals or vice versa? Well, it didn't happen. God made the plants on day 3, he made the animals on day 6. He designed them for their, you know, functions of things that they do. I think if we go back and listen to the tape, we'll find Dr. Figliucci did imply very strongly that fungi and animals have a common ancestor, but it didn't happen quickly, it happened slowly. Now, if you're from Harvard, of course, that happened quickly. Actually, the rule says, you know, punctuate equilibrium. So, if you want to believe that, you're welcome to believe that. That's not science. That's not empirical. Nobody's ever. Fungi are still around today. Okay, why don't they do it again? Let's evolve another something else. Let's evolve another animal, fungi. You got plenty of research money, you ought to be able to do that in your laboratory.
Okay. Dr. Rowe, how do you explain dinosaur extinction?
How do I explain dinosaur extinction? I would say they're probably not even extinct. They're probably a few still around. I think that in the flood in the days of Noah, millions of animals drowned, and plants and everything else. The flood explains the coal we find in the 19 layers all over the world, pressed plants. I mean, there's a layer in Wyoming, 10,000 square miles in the Powder Bluff, Bluff Basin, whatever it's called. Now, some places, 200 feet thick. I think the flood is the only explanation for the fossils at all. Think animals don't fossilize unless they're buried. And I think what happened with the dinosaurs after the flood, those that survived by being on Noah's Ark, probably babies, of course, people killed them. All through history, there are stories of people killing dragons. They called them dragons until 1841, when the word dinosaur was coined by Sir Richard Owen. There was no such word as dinosaur until 1841, so people were killing the dragons, and most of them exterminated by man. Possibly if these dragons are still alive. They're mentioned in ancient history. They find them on all kinds of ancient pottery. Artwork shows pictures of dinosaurs, cave paintings, cliff paintings. There's overwhelming evidence that they've lived with man. I cover that in video number 3.
Sorry about all over. The dinosaurs probably went extinct because of an impact of an asteroid. We have found the crater. The crater is still visible underwater outside of Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. There is geological evidence of the impact of that crater, and the material that meteor was made of was actually scattered all over the world. There are beautiful geological strata in Italy, for example, where I was born, where that show the same exact sequence and the same exact material as in the Yucatan Peninsula. All of these data are very difficult, not impossible, to explain within a creationist perspective. And dinosaurs don't walk the earth right now. Just please find one and bring it here, and then I'll believe it.
Dr. Bucci, how did the Triceratops example prove evolution when they are all variations of the same animal?
Well, that's a matter of opinions, I guess. No, they're not a variation of the same animal. What do you mean by variation of the same animal? Was that a kind? Biologists consider those very different species. In fact, some of those animals are grouped into different genera, which is a higher taxonomic category of biological explanations. So, no, they're very different animals, but not only that, that three that I showed you, of course, goes back further than when I showed you, so it links back to other things that don't look at all like Triceratops. There are other kinds of dinosaurs, and there are intermediate fossils. Now, does that prove evolution? Science is not about proof. And that's another myth that unfortunately is very common and widespread. Science is about our best ideas, our best explanation of how the evidence comes together. So, the best explanation that we have for the diversification of Triceratops is that they were related to each other. By the way, to say that because the fungi are around there today is that animals can possibly have evolved by fungi is the same as saying that you can possibly be your mother's son because your mother is still around. Doesn't make any sense.
How does the Triceratops example prove evolution when they are all variations of the same animal?
The Triceratops example that he gave is different reconstructions of different bones that have been found. Probably there are a variety of Triceratops. There's a variety of dogs. I think nobody would question that a great man and a chihuahua had a common ancestor. But they look awfully different. As far as you said, you've asked the question, I've never been answered, I want to answer it, so you can't say that anymore. What is the kind? The Bible says very clearly, the animals will bring forth after their kind. So those that originally weren't able to bring forth, that is, reproduce children, are the same kind. The Bible kind is those that can bring forth. I said, you asked me to answer the question, how many animals are on the ark? I picked a number that said about 10,000, and you said, I believe in fast revolution or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. You believe all the animals in the world, including all of us, came from a rock. You believe in something that's pretty hard to believe in, from my opinion. Okay. I don't believe the Triceratops evolved from anything. There might have been a variety of Triceratops. There's hundreds of varieties of birds, hundreds of varieties of dogs. There might have been hundreds of varieties of Triceratops.
How do you explain Mendelian genetics?
Say that one more.
How do you explain Mendelian genetics?
Well, Gregory Mendel, the priest who did the study on the pea plants and all sorts of things, you know, the tall ones and the yellow ones and the green ones, he really proved that evolution can't happen. He proved that it's all part of a gene code that is locked in. You know, you can crossbreed your pea plants and you're always going to get peas. You're never going to get corn or tomato. And Mendel proved that it's limited to the genetic code that's already built in. Dr. Migliucci is a plant biologist. He said, if anybody does, just has some kind of evidence of one plant turning into a totally different kind of plant. The monocot, dicot, tricot is not a different kind of plant. Mendel, I think, demonstrated very clearly that evolution doesn't happen. But Mendel's work was kind of ignored for 50 years because Darwin's work was so popular at the time that everybody kind of ignored Gregor Mendel at the same time.
It's interesting to note that every geneticist that I know of is perfectly convinced of evolutionary theory. It doesn't have any problem with evolutionary theory. If you understand what Mendelism is about, there's no contradiction at all. First of all, Mendelism simply explains how organisms inherit their traits, period. Then there are things that are called mutations, for example, that change the genes. And those are inherited because you do need Mendelism in order to have evolution. One of Darwin's problems was that, unfortunately, he didn't read Mendel's paper. The reason was because Mendel published in a very obscure journal. That's one of the problems that every scientist knows about. Never publish in an obscure journal, because then otherwise you're going to be forgotten for 30 years until after you're dead. Darwin was looking for a mechanism for heredity. He needed a mechanism of heredity, and there's a chapter in The Origin of Species that actually said, this is one of the problems of my theory at this point. I don't know how heredity works. Well, now we do. That's the way science works.
Dr. Aldous Huxley, one of the world's leading evolutionists, once claimed that, quote, the reason that we evolutionists jumped at the idea of evolution was because we did not want a god interfering with our sexual mores, end quote. If evolution is purely science, please explain why Dr. Huxley would make such a statement. I can't attest to the veracity.
Yeah, you're the historian here. I'm not sure that Bob Huxley ever said something like that. If he did, that's his own opinion. It's got nothing to do at all with the evidence for evolution, which is entirely independent of the opinions and particular religious beliefs or ethical beliefs of any scientist. As I said before, scientists never going to have an enormous variety of religious beliefs. There are scientists of all sorts of religions or non-religions. So if Huxley said that, and I'm really not sure, I suspect this is one of those examples, those cases like the alleged recantation of Darwin on his deathbed, which probably very likely didn't happen and was made up at the beginning of the century. You should know something about it because you wrote a book in which that is reported. So I suspect that it's simply not true. But even if it is true, it doesn't make any difference. Any single evolutionary biologist can think that all he wants about morality, God, or any other topic that you like, it doesn't make you an expert in that area.
I think I have seen the quote. I don't remember where. I think I could find it, though, if the person who asked the question wanted to contact me. I think it was Thomas Huxley who said, we've accepted Darwin's theory not because of the evidence, but because it gives us sexual freedom, something to that effect. I think I can find that. There's a book we have on the table out there called The Revised Quote Book. No, sorry. That the words may be used against them, which contains thousands and thousands of quotes from scientists from all the ages, and there's a CD in the back, which you can look at very quickly on the CD. You'll probably find it on there. Okay, so I think it's pretty obvious, if evolution is true, you have no basis to determine right from wrong. There's no absolute moral authority. If evolution is true, Hitler was right. Hitler was certainly trying to promote the evolutionary theory. You can read plenty of many folks who've written about him and say, yeah, that was his goal. I ask people this question all the time. Maybe you've got an answer, Dr. Migliucci. If evolution is true, how do we determine right from wrong? Where is the standard to determine right from wrong? If evolution is true. If evolution is true, the strongest survive. It's tooth and claw, struggle for life. And the biggest guy, wins. But if the Bible is correct, then God decides right from wrong. And some people don't like that idea because it checks their mind.
Next question.
Get some Vaseline, man. You're going to need it. We'll be good.
What is the purpose of the other planets and stars?
What is the purpose of the other planets and stars? I don't claim to know the answer. I have a couple ideas. I'm sure I'll get misquoted on this one, too. The planets certainly do shield us from an awful lot of meteor strikes. I mean, if you take a look at the moon, obviously it hits for us quite a few times, as well as Mercury. I think maybe the stars and planets are out there for the oh wow factor. Why do people put chrome on their cars? People go, oh wow. I don't know. I know what name I step outside, look at the stars and the planets, I say, wow, what a mighty God we serve. So, That may be the purpose. It may just be because God's not in control. He doesn't cause him to think of anything. He didn't even lift his finger to make it. He spoke.
Amen.
Everything in the universe was created by the voice of God. When he speaks, the waves lay down, the dead come to life. You know, everything obeys the voice of God. Except some people. Okay?
Not waste all of their precious energy and matter. And by the way, how would you explain based on that hypothesis the fact that the overwhelming majority of stars are simply invisible? How would you go, wow, something you can't see?
Amen.
Anyway, the question was the reason why the stars and planets are there. I don't know. Nobody knows if there is a reason. First of all, the question assumes that there is a reason. There may not be a reason. As far as I know, there may not be a reason. If there is a reason, it's certainly not something that an evolutionary biologist would ever be able to tell you, for one thing. You should ask it at most a cosmologist, and even a cosmologist would think it would have some problems telling you anything about meaning. Science is not about meaning. Meaning you have to find it yourself. Science cannot give you that answer.
Next question. Monkeys evolved into humans as a result of unfavorable environments. Why do monkeys continue to exist?
The grandmother effect. I already answered that question. I think, could we go for another one, or do you want to give an answer to that?
Please name some absolute evidence for evolution.
Absolute evidence for evolution. Well, I don't know what that means, actually. Absolute. Well, I don't know. The fact that the HIV virus is changing under your bloody nose is pretty absolute to me. That is a time, yes, the virus hasn't turned into a banana yet, but nevertheless, it is evolving, and everybody knows. The fact that you might have problems getting infections because antibiotics are selected by natural selection for more and more resistant bacteria is another example of a pretty absolute, you know, for yourself. The fact that you cannot spray any more pesticides in your garden and get it cleaner past because that's an evolved resistance. Well, that's evolution happening under your very nose, so I can see that pretty convincing evidence. There's meant a lot more than that. You can look at the DNA similarity organisms. The fact how do we know that fungi and animals are more closely related to each other than either one of them is related to plants. Because if you look at their molecular structure, their DNA today, it is much more similar than either of them is to plants.
I would say there is no absolute evidence for evolution above the microevolution examples which I gave earlier. I'll let me take the rest of my 1 minute on the stars. The Hubble telescope was asked to look for 10 days at one spot that it thought was black. After 10 days of viewing a spot about the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length above the Big Dipper, they discovered after analyzing the pictures there were more stars than they could count in that area. And I said the same thing. Wow. That's what I said a minute ago. That's for the oh wow factor.
And it worked. Great. Thank you.
Your turn. If we all come from Adam and Eve and sons of Noah, how do we have different races?
How do we have different races? I guess, studying this for quite some time, I've come to the conclusion races is a bad term. We have different colors of people. I think it's very divisive to talk about different races. And I've got that answer on video. Like I said, I have 3,500 pictures. I can't call it up quickly. There are several different theories of where the different skin colors came from. I tend to believe probably the Tower of Babel after the flood is the most likely theory. About 200 years after the flood, there were probably a few thousand people in the world by then, and they were decided to build this tower, you know, in spite of God's commands to get out and spread out and replenish the earth and all that stuff. And so they decided in rebellion to God to build this tower. God came down and confused their languages. The people had to go off then marrying somebody from their own family. Now, in the original creation, this would not be a problem with a pure genetic code. He married sisters with no problem. Adam married his rib with no problem. But after the flood, you would start to have problems, genetic problems, and today we have 3,500 defective genes, and it's just about genetic suicide to marry somebody closer than a first cousin. So probably after the flood, the Tower of Babel, they broke up, everybody speaking French went one way, everybody speaking Italian went someplace else, and the Germans, and et cetera, and they had to marry family. And under those conditions, like the Habsburg dynasty, you start to get some pretty weird-looking rednecks after a while. So I suspect that the races probably came as a result of the inbreeding a few hundred years after the flood Tower of Babel. That's one of four possible explanations from Scripture. That beats believing all the races came from a rock by a long shot.
I wish you would stop saying that. No evolutionary biologist believes that we come from a rock. But anyway, the other thing to do is you realize that he's making it up as we go. I mean, what does it mean to have a pure genetic code? That's not a biological term. I don't know what a pure genetic code is. And in fact, one of the problems with the Adam and Eve story is exactly the man in your rib is not really a good idea. Your children are not going to be in good shape. So I don't even know what the pure genetic code is. There's no such thing. Genetic code is genetic code. Genes are genes. There's no such thing as a pure or an impure gene. Genes are different from each other because of mutations. Some of them work better than others, but they're not pure or not or impure. It's not a genetic term.
What mechanism would you propose to insert new information into the genetic code? Mutation seems unable to do this.
I'm so glad somebody asked that question. First of all, mutations do that, because the mutation is, by definition, a change in information, therefore, encoding the genetic code. Therefore, you do have new information, meaning that you have information that is different from what was there before. If by new information you mean additional information, additional quantity of information, there's several mechanisms that do that. They go under the names of gene duplication, chromosomal duplication, and polyploidy. These are observable under laboratory conditions. You can come to my lab and do it yourself. In a few days or a few weeks, you can actually multiply genes and multiply by natural occurrences, not by artificial means. You can observe genes duplicating themselves, and you can observe chromosomes multiplying into organisms in a way that then they become stable. They have added, essentially, genetic information. So adding genetic information is not the problem. The real question is, what do you do with that genetic information? That's where natural selection comes into play, and it screens out things that don't work very well and keeps things that work a little better. Incidentally, natural selection is not an optimizing mechanism, that is, it doesn't produce perfect things. Sometimes evolution is called the survival of the fittest. A better metaphor is the survival of the barely tolerable. If you're good enough to survive, then you're in, and if you're not good enough to survive, then you're out.
Okay, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution, Pierre Gras says, who's a strong believer in evolution. Mutations are a rescrambling of gene code. It doesn't give you any new information. Polyploidy, as you should know, if anybody, being a plant botanist, that just simply doubles existing information. It doesn't give you new information. It's a copy of the original code. This bull, for instance, has five legs. No new information has been added. He has a copy of a leg put in the wrong place. That's not new information. Here's a short-legged sheep. No new information added. This is a mutation. Two-headed turtle. There's no new information. It's a doubling of information. That is not evolution, and it's not ninja. It's just a mutant turtle. It's scrambling. This biology textbook shows the kids a mutant fly. It says normal flies have two wings. This mutant has four. This rare mutation, like most mutations, is harmful. Beneficial mutations are the raw material for natural selection. Well, excuse me, but why didn't they show us a beneficial mutation? Nobody's ever proven one. And if you did have a beneficial mutation, who would it marry? And who would the grandkids marry and the great-grandkids? You got a real serious problem here. Nobody's ever proven a beneficial mutation. And scrambling information that already exists is not creating new information. And doubling the copying the code, I'm embarrassed that you would say polyploidal is an example of new information. You, if anybody, should know it is not new information.
Dr. Hogan. You acknowledge that variations exist in creationist view of the origin of life, i.e. zebras, horses. All life began 6,000 years ago. Where is the evidence of the birth of these variations? Surely someone would have witnessed the birth of a zebra from a horse or the Great Dane from a chihuahua.
The question is a little convoluted and confusing. Start again.
Okay. You acknowledge that variations exist in creationist view of the origin of life, i.e. zebras and horses. All life began 6,000 years ago. Where is the evidence of the birth of those variations? Surely someone would have witnessed them.
I don't think there's any question that variations happen. The question is, how far can it go? As far as the horse and the zebra having a common ancestor, I don't know when it happened, or even if it happened. I suspect that it could have happened, and that would be a legitimate field of research for scientists. But then to conclude that horses and bananas are related, is way beyond the observable evidence. And I showed you from the textbooks, they do teach the kids we all came from a rock. That's what it boils down to. I know you don't like me saying that. Well, you ought to get rid of that dumb theory and I wouldn't have to say it. Variations happen, but they have limits, okay? Farmers breed for bigger pigs, but they're never going to get a pig as big as Texas. Roaches become resistant to pesticides, but they will never become resistant to a sledgehammer. Okay? Yes, variations happen, but they're limited, and they always produce the same kind of plant or animal. That's not evolution. And the information for the variation is already present in the gene code. Nothing new is ever added. The gene pool of the new variety is now more limited. Somebody spent years developing a Chihuahua. All that work to make a 100% useless dog. Genetic information is lost when you get a variant. Ask any farmer that raises anything. The further you get away from the norm with your hybrid, the more problems you start to have. Either disease resistance goes down, or like the Great Danes, or many dogs have hip dysplasia, you get problems. You might get one desirable trait, like a cow that gives more milk, but you always get some other problem someplace else. And if you turned all the dogs in the world loose back into the woods, 90% of the varieties we have today wouldn't survive. Up in Alaska, probably the long-haired ones would survive, and in the desert, the short-haired dingoes would survive. But you're always going to have a dog. That's not new information.
You did say that 10,000 species gave origin to millions of species in the last 4,000 years. So that question was right. Somebody must have observed that happening one of those times at least. It is also very interesting that you keep saying that nobody has ever observed the origin of a new species. That is absolutely not true. There are some examples in the biological literature of direct observations of the origin of new species, both in animals and in plants. Since you've cited your tapes and books several times tonight, let me quote mine once in a while. There is a table there with references that you can check out of the species, some examples of the species that actually have been observed within historical time, within the last 100 years or so. So speciation, origin of new species, does occur. It's a myth that it does not. I think that's about it for
okay.
That question.
Next question. There's been no mention as to why an eyeball would evolve in the first place. In the absence of a creator or designer, an organism would have to realize that there was a capacity for sight without prior knowledge of it or evidence for it. How could an organism therefore develop sight?
No, that doesn't work that way. The eye originated as a single, very simple pigment that is sensitive to light. You might not think of that as an eye, but if it makes a difference, if you're a microorganism, you're a unicellular organism, you have this little pigment, which is a very simple molecule, by the way, it doesn't require much complexity, and that pigment tells you, look, there's light over there and there's darkness over there, and guess what? Food is actually usually related to light, then you better swim that way. Well, that little pigment is going to make the difference for you between life and death. So eyes don't evolve overnight. They don't evolve because organisms know that they need eyes. As I said before, it is a co-evolutionary process between the organism and the environment. So you start with tiny little steps, one tiny little things which are very simple, and then you become more and more complicated because, in fact, guess what? Once that I can tell if there is light over there and darkness over here, it might be advantageous if a mutation in that pigment or in the structure in which that pigment is actually housed will tell me not only that there is light versus non-light, but it tells me that there is more light in one direction and less light in the other direction, meaning that it's capable of detecting a gradient. From there on, if you can form very simple images, very, very blurred ones, it's very advantageous because any image is better than nothing, and so on and so forth. You keep going that way. By the way, this process has been simulated under computer conditions, and it turns out that the intermediate steps that have been predicted by evolutionary biologists are exactly what a computer simulation will give you if you don't give the program any prior knowledge of where you want to go end up at the end. That's pretty interesting indirect evidence that the eye evolved that way. The other evidence, which is more direct, you can actually look at many of the intermediate steps, because many of the organisms living today still have the intermediate steps. You can find a bunch of gradations of complexity in the eye. It's not that every organism on Earth has a complex eye.
Okay, you misquoted me twice last time. I never said there were 10,000 species on the ark. Get it right this time. I said there are 10,000 kinds. Kinds. Very, very important distinction, okay? And I never said nobody has ever observed a new species. I never said that. Nobody's ever observed a new kind. You got it? Good. Okay. Now, let's go to the eyeball here. Charles Darwin said, "To suppose that the eye could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd." This textbook says the complex structure of the human eye may be the product of millions of years of evolution. This one says, I'll blow it up for you a little bit here, "You can better understand how the eye might have evolved if you picture a series of changes during the evolution of the eye." This is exactly what he said a moment ago. You have to picture it. You have to imagine it. It doesn't take place in reality. You have to imagine how it happened. Imagine an animal with a spot that is sensitive to light. That gives him an advantageous, an advantage over those that don't have this spot. And therefore, he's going to survive and the rest are going to be killed. See, evolution is based on death. One animal evolves a little better than the rest. The rest have to die in order for that one with the spot to take over the population. Evolution is based on the idea that death is wonderful. Death is good. Death's how we get ahead. The bad ones have to die.
Thank you.
That's exactly the opposite of creation. The Bible says God formed the eye. That's the way it happened.
Next question's for you. Dr. Hovind's argument would be nullified if it could be conclusively proven that God does not exist. Please address the existence of God from a purely scientific perspective.
Address the existence of God from a scientific perspective. Here we have an example of somebody defining the argument, and by the definition of their terms for science, of course, they say science has to be observable, testable, demonstrable, and that's going to automatically exclude God. Well, if that's your... They've set up the parameters where it's a no-win situation for the creationist. I think that we have the same situation for those who teach evolution. They believe in the existence of all sorts of things. They believe there are beneficial mutations, though nobody's ever proven one. They believe an animal can produce a different kind of animal, though nobody's ever observed one. It's not part of science. I cannot scientifically prove the existence of God. I can tell you he changed my life a whole lot 31 years ago. Anybody else in that boat? Yeah. There's my evidence right there. Changed lives. He can make the prostitute pure, make the drunkard sober, and make the liar quit lying. He can do amazing things.
I would like to remind Mr. Alvin that this is a scientific debate. We're not in a church. If you want to do something like this in a church, it'll be fine. What was the original question?
Dr. Hovind's argument.
Time for me.
Dr. Hovind's argument would be nullified if it could be conclusively proven that God does not exist. Please address the existence of God from a purely scientific perspective.
Right. Well, as I said, the existence of God. I mean, so on this one, Mr. Darwin is definitely correct. The existence of God is not a scientific question. Not because that doesn't mean that science excludes. I mean, the interpretation is science excludes anything that it cannot analyze. That's a fallacy, and that's a fallacy that plays in his field, but it's completely untrue, and I don't see why he insists in making it. The fact that something cannot be analyzed scientifically doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Okay? Our science, as far as I know, cannot analyze why certain people are so fond of the Three Stooges. Does that mean that there are no people out there that are fond of the Three Stooges? Of course not. Science cannot tell me, at this point at least, why is it that I'm so fond of Monty Python. But then, nevertheless, that doesn't negate that fact. So the fact that there are things that are outside of science, it's not equivalent to say that those things don't exist. On the other hand, I will call again on Hume's dictum. You're making a very extraordinary claim, so where's the evidence? Not scientific, but what kind of evidence do you have at all?
Can any known organism be traced back all the way to one cell?
Yeah, you were born that way. Whoever answered that question. The process of development is not well understood. That is one of the other things. There's a large number of academic journals on developmental biology. Developmental biology is something that we know a lot about, but we know an awful lot. There is an awful lot that we don't know about. But nevertheless, you can observe the development of anything from one cell. In fact, anything, everything develops from one cell. Now, in historical times, how would that happen? Well, I don't see what the problem is there. I mean, if you can see it under your nose over the span of a few hours or a span of a few weeks, I don't see what the problem would be over the spans of millions of years. All you need is, for example, a unicellular cell originally that has a mutation in one and duplicates that cell without then separating them. Now you have a multicellular organism, a two-cellular organism, Okay? If that gets inherited because of the mutation was heritable, then you now have multicellular organisms. It's not that simple. I'm simplifying the situation here, but I don't see any conceptual problem with that kind of thing. Incidentally, this duplication or addition of information, I did say that polyploidy duplicates information. Then mutations come in and they change that information, which means that when you add together the process of polyploidy, which is chromosomal duplication, plus mutations, you have actually created new information, contrary to what you just said.
Okay. You mentioned, read the question one more time so I could phrase it right across. I hate to keep doing this to you, but this is my point-by-point argument again. Let's go point-by-point next time.
I'm sorry, can any known organism be traced back all the way to one cell?
Can any known organism trace back all the way to one cell? If you mean as far as evidence that it evolved from a one-celled creature, absolutely not. What he gave was a far cry from an example of evolution. The human being starts off as one cell and becomes a man. That is because it's following a genetic code. If that's your example of evolution, you're either confused about what evolution is, or you're trying to, again, grossly oversimplify this process. Everything comes from one cell. That is because there's a code it's following, and there's an enormous intake of energy. To get my son from one cell to 22 years old and 6 foot tall took a huge amount of food. There was energy put into this thing. So that is not evolution. If you're teaching your students that that's an example, going from one cell to a fully grown human, that's an example of evolution, you're deceiving your students because it's following a complex genetic code and it is taking in information from the outside. That is not an example of evolution like it's taught in the textbooks. And by the way, where are the two-celled creatures in the world? It would have to go, there are millions, zillions of one-celled creatures. Where are the two-celled or the three-celled or the four-celled? They don't exist, folks, and he ought to know that. They don't exist. There are colonies that get together and do functions, Volvox and stuff like that, but that's a colony of cells. Each one is still an individual cell. That's not anything similar to a tissue or an organ, and there just aren't any. Evolution falls flat, and you talk about Hume's dictum. You're claiming that all life forms came from one cell.
Dr.
You better
Hogan,
have some extraordinary evidence of that.
What about divinely inspired evolution?
What about what?
Divinely inspired evolution.
Divinely inspired evolution. I would say that would be a retarded God that has to use evolution. First place, there's no evidence for evolution anyway, so why should I compromise a perfectly good Bible, which has never been proven wrong, with a dumb theory which has never been proven right? I wouldn't want to make that trade-off. And plus, I would not worship a God that has to use suffering and misfits and death and blind chance and doesn't know what he wants. The God that I worship made it right first time. No mistakes.
You said that your son grew up thanks to a lot of energy. Doesn't that violate the second principle of thermodynamics? Shouldn't have been annihilated by the energy coming in? That was a joke. Thank you. Okay, the question was about what?
The question simply said, what about...
It's fine, by the way.
Divinely
you should
inspired,
try one of these days.
What about divinely inspired
Divinely inspired evolution. Well, I don't know, but you sure could be. You can make the argument that that kind of God would be fairly wasteful. But then again, you know, who are we to make the argument about God wastefulness or not? I think that was one of your objections before. So maybe we don't know. Maybe that is the best way that God can make things, and that's the way it happened. I have no idea. Again, evolution's got nothing to do, evolutionary biologists, they have nothing to say about theology. If you want to believe it that way, that's fine. There's plenty of evolutionary biologists. There's a colleague of mine, Dr. Miller at Brown University, who believes exactly that. He's written a book, if you're interested in that, called Finding Darwin's God or something like that. And that's the theory that he proposes. That's fine, but you should know, reading the book, that's not evolutionary biology. That's his version of theology. Maybe right or not.
Dr. Puglucci, why do animals and humans not evolve today?
They do. I tried to explain this several times. Yes, they do. Animals and humans change their genetic constitutions all the time, every day. Therefore, they are evolving by definition. Now, the question might be, why is it that we don't see species appearing every time, every day? That's a good question. The answer to that is because the speciation process is actually pretty slow, as Darwin did propose. But as I said before, we have observed historical events of speciation, so that's not a problem for evolutionary theory either. And incidentally, talking about Darwin and quoting in a, shall we say, a selective way, that passage from Darwin, from The Origin of Species, that said it may seem absurd that to believe that the eye evolved by natural means. You should have smelled a rat there. The word was, it may seem absurd. You should know that if you go and check that quote, immediately afterwards, Darwin goes on into half a chapter in which he tries to explain how, in fact, the eye evolved. So he says, you know, at first view, it might seem like an absurd thing, but here it is how, in fact, it can happen, and this is what evolutionary biologists have found so far. Selective quoting is pretty dangerous.
Well, we're going to be here all week. Here's the quote. I have the book in the car. I'll get it out next time. To suppose that the eye, with all of its intricate mechanisms for adjusting to light, he has a whole bunch of descriptions of the eye in there, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. Go ahead and read the rest of page 217, 218, and 219, where he talks about his theory of how it might have happened, but it's all speculation. That's not science. Here's how it might have happened. That's what you did. Well, it might have happened, you know, from a one-spotted critter. I'm sorry, that's not science. As far as, was the question about why don't we see animals and humans evolving today? Is that the question we're discussing now?
Why do animals and humans not evolve today?
Well, because God designed them to bring forth after their kind, and that's all they're going to do. Humans are always going to have humans. You might get a big one or a little one, but it's always going to be a human. That doesn't happen. Evolution doesn't happen. So to me, I don't have a problem with that question.
Dr. Hovind, did you teach evolution when you were a teacher in high school? Were you a Christian then?
I was a Christian. I became a Christian at age 16. As I taught school, I taught science, and I tried to teach all sides of the theory. If evolution was presented in the book, I would say, here's one theory. Now here's the evidence against this theory. Here they're telling the kids, you know, you have similar bone structures in your arm compared to a whale. Okay, they can interpret that to be proof of a common ancestor, or you can interpret that to be proof of a common designer. The hubcaps from a Honda Accord will fit on a Honda Prelude. That proves they both evolved from a Chevy 84 million years ago. No, they have similarities because we have a common designer. That's just obvious. So I taught my kids to study science objectively, realistically. Let's look at this. And don't get brainwashed. Don't get taught what to believe. You know, learn how to really think about this. Somebody tells you the human embryo has gill slits, and that proves it used to be a fish. You better study the history of that. That was proven wrong in 1874. Those little folds of skin develop into bones in the ear and glands in the throat. They never have anything to do with breathing. I've seen fat folks that have 5 or 6 chins, and they cannot breathe through any of them but the top one. Okay? Those are not gill slits, and that should not be in the textbooks. So I taught my kids to study science objectively. Okay?
Sure, thanks. This equal time teaching thing is something that needs to be discussed. Education is not about equal time teaching. I mean, if that were the case, then you would be teaching the Copernican theory and the Ptolemaic theory. You would be teaching that the Earth rotates around the Sun and the Sun rotates around the Earth. That's because there are two theories. In fact, historically, they were two theories. Now, that was about 400 and something years ago. Now we know better, therefore we don't teach Ptolemaeus anymore. The day in which somebody finds out that Copernicus was wrong, which is pretty difficult, then we'll teach something else. The same goes for creation and evolution. I mean, creation was a viable theory at one time in history. The last time that was the case was around the 1850s. After that, it has not been a viable scientific theory, which is why we don't teach it. I mean, teaching evolution, teaching in schools, not only public schools, but any school, should be about critical thinking based on the observations and the facts available. It's not about dogma. No evolutionary biologist should ever teach evolution as a dogma. And if they do, they're simply mistaken. They don't understand what education is all about. But it is the only viable theory at this point, scientific theory at this point. It may be wrong, perhaps. But certainly creationism is not the alternative.
This may have been addressed, but forgive the or blame the moderator if it has. Do you believe, Dr. Puglucci, that the tailbone is vestigial?
That the tailbone is vestigial. Oh, I see. Okay, yes, let's talk about these vestigial things, because I know that Mr. Robin, if I say yes, Mr. Robin will say, well, then why don't we have, I'll pay for a operation for your tailbone to be taken out and see how you feel. Right? I'm learning the game here. Okay. Now, it is very serious, you're right, but, you know. Vestigial organs are not, contrary to what most people think, organs that don't have any function. If they didn't have any function, they probably would have been lost long ago. These are organs that used to have a different function, and they now have shifted to something else. A great example of it is if you observe many animals that live in caves. Animals that live in caves usually either don't have eyes or they have greatly reduced eyes. The reason for that, that's a great example of when you find very reduced eyes in cave animals, it's a great example of evolution, because the reason that happens is because it costs metabolically quite a bit for the organism to build the eye. It's a complex structure, so it costs energy. Okay, and if you don't need it, then there will be natural selection against forming eyes, which is exactly what we see. So you see over a period of time, with all the intergradations that you want, you see the eyes disappearing in cave animals, so that you can find the cave animals that have non-functional eyes and eyes that are that are only half there or a quarter there, and they're completely gone. That is the way vestigial organs work. So in the case of the tailbone, it's the same situation. The tailbone doesn't function anymore as it does in other primates, that is, as a tailbone, because we don't have any tails anymore. But it does have other functions. There are some muscles that are attached to it, so you can't get rid of it entirely. But it is exactly the same bone that other animals, very close related to us, actually use as a tailbone, which is, again, how evolution works, by changing things around gradually, little by little.
Yes.
Yes, sir. I certainly would pay to have yours removed anytime you'd like. you mentioned about cave animals losing their eyes, and you said this is a great example of evolution. I think it should be obvious to a kindergartner that losing something is not evolution. That's the opposite of evolution. You're going backwards in time, okay? You're losing something, not gaining something. The textbook says the appendix is vestigial because you don't need it anymore. Well, you better study your anatomy because the appendix is part of the immune system. You can live without your appendix, that's true, but if your appendix is taken out, you have a higher susceptibility to many diseases. You could live without both your legs and both your arms and both your eyes also. That doesn't prove you don't need them, okay? You do need your appendix. By the way, that's not Reader's Digest. In the beginning, Walt Brown is out there, a good book to read. This one says the whales have a vestigial pelvis. First place, I'd like to point out there is no vestigial pelvis in a whale, okay? Those bones are necessary for reproduction, like we mentioned earlier. This book says humans have a tailbone they no longer need. I've volunteered many times. If you think it's vestigial, I'm serious, I'll pay to have yours cut out. I'll do it right now. Bend over, okay? And it doesn't just... This proof of design, okay, we're perfectly designed. The spine has to end somewhere. Why not there? And arguing from vestigial organs is a lousy argument for evolution. First place, there aren't any vestigial organs, and if there were, that's the opposite of evolution. That's losing, not gaining.
Okay, the next question for you, Dr. Hovind. Your scientific theory was proposed, it says about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. I think they mean... It was proposed concerning about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, before we knew anything other than what we could see. How do you think they got it right scientifically?
Are they referring to the Bible being written 3,000 years ago, and how do I think they got it right scientifically? I think it's amazing that they did. I mean, nobody's proven anything scientifically wrong. The Bible says the earth is round. The Bible says there are currents or paths in the sea. Murray studied those based on the Bible verse in the book of Psalms and discovered the ocean currents and has saved the world billions of dollars in shipping costs. If you know something scientifically wrong with the Bible, I'd like to see it. I know thousands of things that are told in the Bible way before they were discovered. The Bible says in the book of Job from 3,000 years or 4,000 years ago that the sun causes the wind. And ask any weatherman what causes the wind currents. The sun heats up the ground, causes warm air masses to rise and spread out. Exactly right. The Bible has lots of scientific statements. It's not a science book, but when it deals with science, it's right.
Which version of it? Of course. Now, the interesting thing about the Bible is that, of course, it's not a scientific text. Nobody except creationists would argue that it is a scientific textbook. It is a very interesting historical document that was written over a long period of time by many different authors. Bible scholars agree on that thing, and it is right. It was written by people that knew next to nothing about science. It is true that the Bible says, for example, that the earth is round in one place. But then there are a couple of other places in which it says or it implies that it is flat. And there are several other things. There are places in which the Bible says or it implies that, in fact, the earth is the center of the universe and the sun rotates around it. Is that surprising? No, because that was the theory that was held by most people at that time. It has only one problem. It's wrong.
What is the evidence that the intermediate organisms are actually intermediate and are not distinct termina of lines?
Oh, that's a good question. It's not that easy to tell. In fact, you can't. If you look at an organism that is intermediate, you cannot be sure ever, you can never be sure that that organism was on direct line of descent of something else that came after or became first. This is what Mr. Darwin referred to as they're just dead bones problem. But that is not how science works. Again, science doesn't work. Historical science, which is what evolution biology is, doesn't work by direct observation necessarily. In some cases you can work by direct observation, in some cases you don't. The way it works is this. Look, if there is a whale now and there was this organism back there in 55 million years ago, which we think for some reason was an ancestor of the whale, then in between you should find certain forms that look pretty much like this, like the ones that I showed you before. That is a prediction. When that prediction can be tested and can be falsified, therefore, if those forms are never found, or in fact, worse, if forms that don't fit that sequence are found, that is a falsification of evolutionary theory. So it's got nothing to do with experiment in this case, because you're talking about fossils. I mean, unfortunately, fossils don't reproduce freely. I've tried to put two ammonites in the same drawer and sound the violins, but nothing happens. But nevertheless, they are the intermediate forms that we do know about follow exactly the predictions of evolutionary theory. Look, sometimes I'm asked, how is it that you could possibly falsify evolutionary theory? Find one bone of a human being or of a dinosaur in Precambrian rocks, and that will falsify evolution right there. But we know of millions and millions of bones in strata all over the world, and it has never been found.
Dr. Hoven?
Interesting. Okay. Well, again, we got 6 points brought up. The Bible does not teach the earth is flat. The Bible says it's round, Isaiah chapter 40. The Bible does not teach the earth is the center of the universe. If somebody says I went 50 miles an hour down the highway, technically you're going 50 miles an hour down the highway, plus you're going 700 miles an hour around the earth here at this latitude, plus you're going 66,000 miles an hour around the sun, plus the sun's going around the galaxy at a certain speed. So you lied when you said you're going 50 miles an hour. No. You gave the obvious evidence to an earthbound observer. The weatherman this morning said, sunrise at 7:15. Was he lying? No, that's the way it is to an earthbound observer. It looks like the sun is rising. That's not lying. Now, as far as you're saying that the whale's 55 million years ago and all this stuff, you're basing everything on the assumption that that dumb geologic column means something. Those layers of earth are given a different age. All this was done in the early 1800s, Charles Lyell, 1830. Darwin didn't like round numbers, so he said one of the layers was 306,662,400 years old. But those layers are not different ages. They find petrified trees standing up all over the world, running through multiple layers of rock. Now, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. If you have petrified trees that are standing up and they're running through rock layers, the layers are the same age, all formed in the flood of Noah.
Serendipitously, I have a related question for you. Can you explain why there are no large animal fossils in the lowest levels of sediment?
Can I explain why there are no large animal fossils in the lowest layers of sediment?
I.e., the oldest fossils, sedimentary layers.
Okay. First place, if you found a large animal fossil in any layer, who's going to decide the age of that layer? Somebody who already has the preconceived idea that this geologic column means something? Well, if the evolutionists get to make all the decisions of what goes where, then of course the evidence is going to fit their interpretation. But I would point out that animals automatically sort based upon, in a flood, they sort based upon body density, based upon intelligence, based upon habitat, based upon mobility, and certainly based upon liquefaction. There's an interesting phenomenon that takes place when waves come by. The high part of the wave is heavier than the low part of the wave. If I knew that question was coming, I could have got into that here. on liquefaction. I got plenty of stuff on that. But pressing and relieving the pressure on sand, you can go down to the beach where I live in Pensacola, Florida, just walk out a few feet and stand there. As the waves come by, the pressure exerts, squeezes water into the sand, then the low part of the wave comes by, the pressure is relieved, and sand is actually hopping up off the bottom. If you don't move a muscle, within a few minutes, you'll be knee-deep in sand. Liquefaction is what it's called. A guy took an aquarium full of sand, rocks, gravel, mud, grass, trees, a bunch of different things, and dead fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, mixed them all together, and subjected it to liquefaction for a couple of days, and it sorted them. Fish went to the bottom, birds went to the top, based on liquefaction. You need to study, get the book In the Beginning by Walt Brown. The flood is the best explanation for the sorting of the fossils we find, not some evolutionary sequence.
It is very interesting that you keep mentioning the geological column as if it were invented by evolutionary biologists to explain how things work by evolution. In fact, the geological column was invented by creationist geologists before Darwin's publication of The Origin of Species. So that's pretty difficult to use it as an anti-evolution argument. The other thing is, I really doubt that Darwin said 3,662,000,000,000, blah, 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 and that quotation was from a creationist book. It was probably made up. I'd like you to show me where it was published in Darwin's book. I've never seen it, but anyway, that precise. Darwin wasn't that precise. He knew better. You quoted, could you stop the time? You quoted at one point a certain figure, precise figure that Darwin has said about the,
This concerns sedimentary layers. Can you explain why there are no large animal fossils in the lowest level of sedimentary rock?
What was that again?
That was the original question.
Yeah. But anyway, so the geological column is not a problem for evolutionary biology, simply because, first of all, it is derived independently from the fossil record, because you can date the rocks with absolute dating methods. And second of all, because it was actually invented by creationists. And if we have to go back to the Bible, I hate to do this, but quotes about four-cornered earth, an earth with four corners and a firmament staying on pillars, that seems pretty awfully suspicious as a metaphor for a weatherman. But if you think that that's what it is, that's fine. Go ahead.
How could there be transitions from plants to animals and increasing complexities in other species with no living species that is also transitional alive, specifically ape to human? I think they're looking for a living example.
A living example of a proto-human. We killed them all. It's pretty easy. Yeah. There are examples, there are plenty of examples of intermediates, by the way, of among different species of both animals and plants. The human lineage is pretty small, incidentally. There are only a few species that belong to the human lineage. And that really, truly is because most of them went extinct. Probably the latest intermediate stage, or the latest close relative to us, which was Neanderthal man, it went extinct several thousand years ago, of course. And possibly one of the explanations is that it went extinct because we did kill him. We are pretty good at killing, if you haven't noticed. We have been directly responsible for the extinction of countless species, both in historical times and today. I'm not just blaming McDonald's. It has been the history of humankind all over again. So, yeah, if the species are very close to each other, by the way, there is a very well-known principle in ecology that says that those species are going to be in very high competition with each other. And you can actually demonstrate with laboratory experiments that the result of very high intense competition between forms that are very similar to each other is that one of the two is going to go down the drain. One of them is going to go extinct. So very likely that's what happened to other proto-humans. But the fossils are still there. They're telling us the story. So I don't really see what the problem is.
I'm going to need that question one more time. I got lost in the shuffle here.
How can there be transitions from plants to animals and increasing complexities in other species with no living species that is a transition alive, specifically ape to human?
How can there be no living species transition, specifically apes to humans? I think if you get the book called Bones of Contention by Marvin Lubinow, who spent 25 years studying all of the so-called cavemen, you would find that every one that has been used as evidence has been disproven. You mentioned Australopithecus afarensis, better known as Lucy. Charles Oxnard studied Lucy, did a computer multivariate analysis of all the bones, spent 16 years studying Lucy, and so he's the most knowledgeable expert in the world, and he believes in evolution, but he said, folks, Lucy is just an unusual chimpanzee. It is not a missing link. So you need to study Oxnard's work on that before you tell your students we have evidence that Lucy is a missing link. And we've got a whole series. The book out there is the best one by Marvin Lubinow. Every one that's been used as evidence for humans, for evolution of humans, has been disproven. There is no evidence that any animal has ever produced a different kind of animal. None at all. You can believe that if you want, but that's not science. That's the whole point of this discussion tonight.
If one is willing to trust science to light this room, when we go to the doctor, when we drive our cars and eat our food, why can't you trust the same science that tells us we evolve?
If one can trust science to go to the doctor and drive our cars, why can't I trust the same science that tells us we evolved? I'd sure like to know what evolution, anything evolution has done for the advancement of science. All of the major branches of science were started by creationists. And the evolution theory has nothing to do with any of those things you mentioned. I mean, I understand electricity. I've built many buildings and wired, done a lot of my dad was an electrical engineer. I understand how it works. It has nothing to do with evolution. Neither does driving a car. I've done about everything you can do to a car. I've rebuilt everything, and evolution has nothing to do with that. I think science deals... The whole problem is the question assumes that evolution should be part of science. That's where the problem comes in. That's my whole point. Evolution, at least above the variations within the kind, it doesn't happen. It doesn't belong in science class. It shouldn't be there. So evolution has nothing to do with science, and the poor students are being duped into all this, and everybody else is having to pay for it.
The claim that evolution didn't do anything for mankind is pretty interesting. One of the reasons we have some cures that are fairly effective against certain diseases, such as cancer and hopefully to some extent HIV, is because of our understanding of evolutionary processes. You know how cures against very lethal diseases like those work? They work by, one of the most effective ways to do it is by bombarding the agent, the virus or the bacterium, with multiple antibiotics. You know why you bombard them with multiple antibiotics instead of only one? Because scientists understand evolution, and they know that if you bombard something with one antibiotic, the thing that you're going to do is to select, by natural selection, for a very resistant strain of that thing. And so, yes, you're going to solve the problem right now, but then it's going to bite you right back in the next few generations. On the other hand, they also know, because they understand evolution, that if you hit something with triple hits or quadruple hits, that thing cannot produce a single mutation that will cope with all of those four things simultaneously. That is why an understanding of evolution is not only crucial for an understanding of science in general, but it's actually helping people to try to figure out solutions to problems such as diseases like cancer and HIV.
Why do Occam's statements substantiate a legitimate objection to the idea of intelligent design?
Say that again? Who's?
Occam's theorem.
Oh, Occam's.
Why is that a legitimate objection to the idea of intelligent design?
Because intelligent design is one of those things that Occam would call an unnecessary hypothesis. In other words, if you can explain something with natural means, natural laws, then you don't need a supernatural intervention. Now, as I said before, I think, several times, the fact that you don't need a supernatural intervention doesn't mean that there is no supernatural thing at all. That's outside of what we're talking about. It only means that it is an additional hypothesis that is not needed in order to understand how things actually work. Science as a process, not just biology, evolution, biology, it works that way. Successful scientific theories over and over have been theories that have been within the limits of Occam's razor, that is, that have made the fewest number of unnecessary hypotheses. This is, by the way, not to say people sometimes mistake this for saying, well, then the simpler hypothesis is the one to win, and God did it is the simplest hypothesis you can come up with. That's not the way it works. The way it works is for unnecessary hypothesis. It doesn't have anything to do with simplicity or complexity. An hypothesis can be very complex if the thing that you have to explain is very complex. And evolution is a very complex hypothesis because it relies on a variety of different statements.
Good point. Occam's razor, he says that you don't need the supernatural because it can be explained naturalistically. Evolution has never explained in detail how anything has evolved. They make up all these wild stories of how they think it might have happened. You need to read Michael Behe's book called Darwin's Black Box if you want to see the real complexity of things. I understand how cars work. They're made from 100% natural products. There's nothing supernatural about a car. But obviously there was a designer. If I told you that a Corvette evolved from an explosion in a junkyard, you would think I was crazy. If I told you that lightning strikes and hurricane strikes, even Hoyle, who said, you know, a tornado going through a junkyard will not assemble a Boeing 747. Even though a Boeing 747 is made of all natural parts, it still has to have a designer. I was in Japan a couple of weeks ago, but I did not see the guy who designed the Casio Data Bank watch. Whether I see the designer or not doesn't matter. This had a designer. And whether you believe in God or not doesn't matter. This universe was designed, and you will answer to him someday real soon.
We have time for one more question here. Today we are listening to a debate on two theories of creation. Why is this discussion not occurring in the public school systems of America?
I answer first on that one?
Yes, you
okay.
do.
Why is this discussion on creation evolution not occurring in public schools? Man, I wish it was. I speak in hundreds of public schools, and I think students ought to see both sides. And I'm thrilled that UT would invite, you know, this to happen here. They ought to also invite creation speakers to come speak in every evolutionary biology class. Give them some equal time. There's never been a law against teaching creation in the public schools. Any teacher tomorrow or whenever, Monday, can teach creation if they want. Two states passed laws requiring teachers to teach creation, and those laws were struck down only because the states required that creation be taught. The court clearly said, you can teach creation if you want, but you cannot require the teachers to teach it. That's what the argument was about. Anybody can teach creation or the Bible in a public school, for that matter. There's no law against that. There never has been. I think evolutionists don't want creation brought in side by side because then their theory starts to look pretty silly next to the creation theory. I think that it's a no competition type of thing. They don't want any competition for their theory.
Actually, I happen to disagree with most of my colleagues. I think that that creationists should be discussed in public school. It shouldn't be taught as an alternative scientific theory because it is not, but it should be discussed because so many people believe it, and there is a good reason for why people believe it. There is an enormous social movement about it. Therefore, you need to take into account that, and it's a great exercise in critical thinking, incidentally. So I do think that these topics should be discussed in public school, and I teach... I do practice what I preach because I'm teaching a course on the origin of species, incidentally, this semester at UT. And one of the things that my students will be doing is to have an online chat at the end of the semester with Michael Behe to discuss creationism, intelligent design, and things of that sort. So I think it's a great exercise for their critical thinking. I quite frankly think that they're going to tear him to shreds, but that's going to be his problem. He kindly agreed to do that, and we'll have some fun. The transcripts of that will be posted on my website, so if anybody's interested at the end of the semester, they can go and see what my students did against Michael B., a sort of an indirect debate.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Drs. Hovind, Dr. Pagliucci, thank you very much.